Chicago Tribune environmental reporter Michael Hawthorne, legendary punk rock bass player Mike Watt, and another installment of the Swap Meet with Greg Clam. Now, here's your host, a man who thinks we can balance the budget with a tax on all staff emails, Justin Kaufman.
Right? Who's with me? Double the tax if you reply all. A surcharge if it's a joke. Or an emoji. Welcome to the download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock tonight. Excited to be here. Beautiful night in Chicago. Lots to do. It's unbelievable to think that today is the final day of May. May 31st. Just like that. You blink your eyes. I feel like it was April 7th. We blink our eyes. It's now May 34th. We're past Memorial Day. It's crazy. And lots to talk about tonight. There's a lot going on in our state when it comes to state government, a lot going on with our world when it comes to climate change. And, of course, there's just a lot going on when you got Mike Watt in studio. Mike Watt, the legendary punk rock bass player for bands like the Minutemen, Firehose, also did the reunion tour with the Stooges. Mike Watt was in town playing with the Meat Puppets. Stopped by to talk about his career, his music, what's going on in his life, inspiration, passion, punk rock, all of it. He's my guest at the big table tonight. How great is that? You get a chance to talk to a guy who's had such an influence on so many musicians. Think about all of the musicians who have come up through punk music and the sort of punk pop explosion, whether it be Green Day, Blink 182, Fall Out Boy. A lot of those bands, almost all of them, point back to the Minutemen and Mike Watt as the inspiration. And they were one of those bands as well that at the time they played small shows, did everything sort of DIY, jam and econo, right? And then it was years later that more bands started saying, oh, it's the Minutemen. They had a resurgence after they were long gone. So we'll talk with Mike Watt about sort of post-popularity coming up. At the big table tonight, Michael Hawthorne is going to join us. I'm excited. He's such a great writer. Michael Hawthorne has covered environmental politics, public health, and others as an investigative reporter for the Chicago Tribune. And, you know, when I saw the story today that President Trump is withdrawing from the Paris Accord, you know, I'm like a lot of people who are listening right now, don't know what that means, what impact that has on how we view and deal with climate change. We'll talk with Michael Hawthorne about that coming up in the 9 o'clock hour. But the big story here in Chicago, in the state of Illinois, the third straight fiscal year without a budget. The spring session in Springfield came to a close today. I think it's still technically going on. But today was the last day, and the budget did not make it through the House, did not get to the governor's desk. We will go another year without a balanced budget in the state of Illinois. Hard to believe. And, you know, and I think about it, I remember, Pete, you'll remember this, but I remember the first year we started was the first year of the showdown. And we had Kristen McQuarrie in here,
mm-hmm.
and we had a bunch of lawmakers call up about how they didn't get it done. I remember Kristen just being great, just sort of just
laying
unloading.
Into it, yeah.
You can do your job. To think of that moment, which was probably May 31st, 15. To blink our eyes and be in the same studio in the same spot on Michigan Avenue and to have the same conversation about inaction in Springfield, it's pretty amazing. Mike Fouché will be here from the Daily Line for his regular Wednesday checkup, and we will get into it about why it didn't happen and what it means for the state of Illinois. Hey, schools, social service agencies, universities, and, of course, the 2018 gubernatorial election. That's all coming up. We'll talk with Mike about that after the 7:30 news. Also, hey, I'm excited. All of the gloom and doom about what's happening in the world, we always, always have the swap meet. If things go south, if the planet dries up and dies, we don't have any money from our government, we can always sell the junk in our garage. And that's Greg Flam at DuPage Picker joins us at 10 o'clock like he does every Wednesday night, 312-981-7200. I love it. It's so great. It's so true. That that stool that you have in the basement, you're like, ah, it's a Coors Light stool I got in 1977. It could be worth like $1,500 right now. So we love evaluating your memorabilia, your collectibles, your junk. Swap meet tonight. News, weather, and traffic with Rob Martier and Esmeralda Leon. Production provided by, of course, Pete Zimmerman. I'm Justin Kaufman. This is The Download, a show about Chicago starring those who know it well. All right, we'll take a break. We'll come back. We'll do the carryout. Stay with us. It's The Download here on 720 WGN. Justin Kaufman. We've got a great show lined up. Let's start with the carryout. Here are today's top cafefes. Shocker! Extra, extra! Read all about it! Actually, there's nothing to read because our lawmakers in Springfield didn't do anything! So for the third year of Governor Rauner's first term, we once again do not have a budget in place. Wow. I guess the takeaway is that budgeting is bullcrap? I mean, really. Everything from my home ec teacher, everything that she taught me was nonsense, and all I have to do is keep spending and just hope that I stay about 20, 30 days ahead or if there's an election. I don't remember that chapter. I do remember having to carry around an egg. So what's it mean? Well, technically, the fiscal year doesn't end until July, so there's time to come up with money for schools, universities, and social services. But history has proven that the state just doesn't care about those things. They could say they do in press releases and duct tape commercials, but actions speak louder than words. Both sides of the aisle don't have the taxpayers' interests in mind at all. Democrats, you didn't pass a balanced budget with new revenue because you ran the data and you would give your opponents fodder for the next election. You left your constituents high and dry with the hopes that their misery would give you more power to do the same things again in 2018. That's ridiculous. Somewhat pathetic. And Republicans, you don't even participate for the same reason. And you went even further. You're breaking the system just to make Illinois more business-friendly rather than funding a nursing home or an inner-city elementary school. If you couldn't get more favorable worker comp rules, then nobody gets nothing. Oh, wait, that's the new slogan. Illinois, nobody gets nothing. So now what? My guess is that we hear the word jumble of failure, taxpayer, millionaire, social, service, structural, and reform for the next 2+ years. Oh, joy. Let's move on. Something more uplifting. Well, it looks like President Trump is taking his ball full of coal and carbon and greenhouse gases, and he's going home. The president will pull us out of the Paris Accord and climate change because it could be bad for American workers and, well, Obama. We join Syria and Nicaragua as the only countries who are not committed to fight climate change. Syria and Nicaragua. One country uses chemical weapons on its people, and the other's main export is pollution. So there you go. So what now? Well, after this big diesel dance party in D.C., no one knows. The other countries involved said they're moving forward, and we're supposedly still interested in addressing climate change. But we still need more proof that regulations won't be job killers for certain industries. That's why you have a new EPA chief who has sued the EPA on behalf of said industries. Might I also say, and I know it's not popular. I know it. Right off the gate, I know everyone's going to be mad at me. But this is why you don't elect a president who's in his 70s. You really think he's got the planet's best interests in mind 50 years down the line? Come on. It's about the now. And the later? Well, that's just not now. Sorry. I understand. People get mad about that, but there's a difference. I think there's a younger generation that doesn't see any which way that this works out for the planet. All you have to do is just be in agreement. It's a mental handshake. Do we have a problem with climate change? Yeah, I think we do. Yeah, right? No, not me. I don't think so. And here we are. The only way someone like President Trump will address climate change is if an unseasonable hurricane hits Mar-a-Lago. Right? Until then, diesel for everybody. I understand the desire to forge a new direction for this country. But I need some clarification on why everyone else in the world is on board and we think we're better. There's Make America First and there's Make America Great. I get that. But Make America alone, it just doesn't roll off the tongue. And what is our yo-yo-like response to climate change? It's like we only care about it when it happens. It's like an alcoholic that admits that he's got a problem when caught in a bender. But once he's sobered up, he balks on throwing out the liquor cabinet. Hey, yeah, I'm clean. And that booze costs money. Just leave it the way it was. I'll never binge again, I promise. Now go make me a Tom Collins. So no health care, no climate change, no immigration. So what's next? Ah, no birth control. Yep. A new draft of a new mandate was leaked. It would expand exemptions for any employers who morally or religiously object to offering birth control on healthcare plans. Let me guess how many women worked on that draft. Let me see here. Mike, no. Jared, no. Donald, Steve. I mean, Lindsay is a girl's name, but... Kathy Griffin, pass. She got fired from CNN's New Year's Eve celebration for her photo. Good. I mean, good for us, right? The viewers. She was awful at it. Also, that's your protest picture? A bloody beheaded head of the president? Yeah, real edgy to hate on Trump. Really nailed it. Also, can we all avoid broad strokes on this one? Kathy Griffin does not represent the left. And also, Ted Nugent, he doesn't represent the right. We cool, mainstream media? We figured this out? Because you're playing right into these losers' hands, right? In weather, beauty. A little kafefe, but still, beauty. In sports, the Cubs got swept by the San Diego Padres. They lost today. What? Two straight sweeps, six losses in a row. What's going on? The Cubs are now two games under 500. Was it Soler? Do we need to trade to get Soler back? Is that what's missing? Is it Jorge? Cubs can't hit when it counts. They seem to be folding when the game's on the line. Even dressing up all 70s seems off this year. I think we shake it up. I think we start rebuilding for the future. Trade them all for 14-year-old prospects. Kyle Schwarber for 3 8th graders from the Dominican Republic. Right? The only good news is that the NL Central kind of sucks this year. So they're only two back. More bad news, if the Sox win tonight, the Cubs and Sox will have identical records on June 1st. Let that one sink in, Cubs fans. The Sox are hoping for a series win against the Red Sox tonight. Last night, Chris Sale was back, and he was not good. But he was better than the terrible Jose Quintana, who continues to ruin our grandiose plans to trade him for 3 8th graders from the Dominican Republic. But the Red Sox media has this whole, the White Sox are really feeling it now that they let Sale go. Oh, he's so great. Give me a break. It's June. Can't wait to for him to give up 7 runs to the Yankees when the playoffs are on the line in September. And he will. Watch him. Trust me on that one. And then he's going to get mad at the clubhouse guy for putting guards on all the sharp objects. Anyway, the Sox without Sale are still in the hunt for the AL Central, which is also a pretty sucky division. News out today, the Hawk Harrelson will return for one more season with the White Sox, then retire. Hawk, who was once named the worst broadcaster in all of baseball by GQ Magazine, doesn't do home games right now, just goes out on the road. I love Hawk Harrelson. I'm a Hawk guy. Why? Because I like my baseball broadcasters to have style, personality, and to sometimes get lost in their own sentences. That's right. That's the Chicago way. And finally tonight, game two of the Stanley Cup playoffs. Stanley Cup final is in Pittsburgh tonight. Pittsburgh officials did charge a Nashville fan with a bunch of inane crimes for smuggling in and throwing a catfish on the ice in game one. I guess it's a tradition, or at least a dumb knockoff tradition, throwing octopus in Detroit. So the next time you smell something fishy around you, it may be that someone just taped a dead catfish to their leg. I can't even get the joke out. That's the carryout for May 31st, 2017. Hey, we made it through another month. Dead catfish for everyone. Want to add some cafefe with that? Dollar extra. All right, coming up, Mike Boucher will break down what happened or didn't happen in Springfield today. No budget. The House did not push the Senate plan to the governor's desk. So what's it mean for the state of Illinois? It's coming up, 720 WGN. Stay with us. Rob Martier, how are you, my friend?
Good evening, buddy. How are you?
Have you ever taped a catfish to your leg?
Can't say as though I have, although I was in a fraternity, so you never know. Maybe I had one there and just didn't realize it, or just felt like a catfish was taped to my
leg. Felt, if that was a tradition of your favorite hockey team, and you're like, I need to, you know, I need to show up, I need to represent, I need to tape this catfish to my leg, get past security, you do it?
What's amazing is that you would figure that heading into where the Pittsburgh Penguins play, that somebody would get a whiff of said catfish and maybe pull that guy to the side.
Be like, what's wrong, man?
Don't you think that'd be pretty rank? I mean, you know, right, he's walking with a catfish. And this was no small catfish either that was thrown on the ice. This thing was huge.
Oh, man.
The world's gone crazy, man.
That really, if you were going to pick one story to be like, the world's gone crazy.
I mean, you figure it's three rivers in Pittsburgh, right? It's the Monongahela, the Allegheny, I guess it makes the Ohio River or something like that. You figure they'd pull out like an Asian carp.
Right, right.
You know, instead of like a catfish. I mean, that would be more indigenous.
See, that would be a more Chicago Blackhawks move.
Sure.
Right?
Yeah.
If we threw an Asian carp up on the...
why not?
The United
States. Good for something, right?
We need to bring that tradition in. Thanks, Rob. It's Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman.
What up, man? This is great. I'm going to have a really exciting, upbeat conversation. You know, one of the things that I love about coming
here to WGN
is being upbeat and excited about government. This is the upbeat voice, guys. I know that you've been listening to me for a while, but this is what I sound like when things are great.
Mike Boucher from the Daily Line joins us every Wednesday to talk about politics, whether it be city, regional, state, county.
And I always get to talk like this.
And he brought his optimistic voice with him today.
Yeah.
And a very pessimistic day in Springfield. All right, so the final day.
Talk about terrible things.
Yeah, I mean, well, let's get to it, because today was the deadline for the spring session on whether or not Springfield would be able to balance a budget for the first time in 3 years.
Right.
There was hope this time around because the Senate passed a budget and a spending plan, not
right.
necessarily balanced, but
right.
up closer to the
right.
idea. And there was talk that this could be, the House could push, Mike Madigan pushed this to the governor's desk, and we may be closer than we ever have been in the rounder term.
In the last 2 years.
To actually having a balanced budget. But the House today doesn't do anything.
They didn't do a thing. And, you know, really, I mean, it seems like there's really nothing going on, but in reality, there is a lot going on. In reality, Madigan has been having these meetings with his caucus, the Democrats, the House Democrats, who have a controlling vote of the House. And he has been polling them to see if he could get enough votes in order to pass a budget. And as of yesterday afternoon, and it seems like this morning, there weren't enough votes among the House Democrats in order to pass a budget.
Now, are they talking about the budget that was passed out of the Senate? Are they working on their own version of that? What budget are we talking about?
The initial conversations were about the Senate version. And then later it became, okay, what are the other things that people are going to need? But, you know, really what this is about is that there's really kind of three things that are on the table. Well, there's lots of different things that are on the table, but three big things that we're talking about here. One, which is Governor Rauner's assistance on a permanent property tax freeze. And two is a need to have some sort of money that goes to schools, both higher ed and district schools.
Yeah, right.
And then the other is having some sort of budget that keeps the state going in order to pay for all the different agencies that do the stuff.
Right.
And there's this, you know, problem, which is that Rauner says, I'm not going to do anything unless there's a permanent tax freeze, property tax freeze. And the other is that Democrats started rolling out yesterday a school funding bill, which was fairly large and gave a lot of money to Chicago and to other districts as well. But Rauner said, no, I'm not going to do that because there's not enough money for it. We're not going to be paying
right.
for that.
Let's work on the budget. We'll work on that afterwards or
well,
in whatever
but
order.
The problem that Democrats have, especially the ones from Chicago, is that money for schools is what the budget is. And not just, you know, the regular high schools and elementary schools, but also for the universities. And we just learned today that Northeastern Illinois University, which is a state school, is going to be cutting, you know, I think 120, 140 jobs because they just can't sustain people. There's, you know, other stuff that's been going on. I know Western Illinois University has had cuts. Northern Illinois University has had cuts. Eastern Illinois University has had cuts. You know, the big ones, UIC and SIU and
U of I,
you know, they're probably in better shape because they have endowments and all kinds of other things that they can draw on. But the smaller ones, they're in a lot of trouble. So, you know, really what we got down to today is that the Democrats in the House felt like they weren't going to be able to vote for something that Rauner was probably going to veto. And what they were most concerned about is that they were going to vote for tax increases. And they were probably going to try and come up with more tax increases. And they were concerned that they would be left out to dry, that they don't want to vote to pass something unless Governor Rauner is going to say, okay, I'm going to take some risk too and
okay,
sign this
Okay, I understand that because there's some political risk in passing or not passing anything. But isn't there an advantage politically to say, hey, we balanced the budget. Here you go, governor. And the governor is on the hook to say, I veto this because I didn't get what I wanted out of it. And the state of Illinois residents go, hey, I mean, it's interesting that the Democrats in the House didn't see beyond that idea.
You know, it's interesting is that business interests in Illinois, like the most conservative business interests that you can think of.
They want a budget.
They want a budget, 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 budget. We don't care. Just give us a budget. But the truth is that it's regular Joe and Jane voters that are the ones that really get the attention of state representatives. And their nightmare scenario is that they go back to the district and they're in the neighborhood coffee shop or whatever it is, they're in the grocery store, and somebody starts hassling them about raising their taxes. That is, I know that because you know people have told me that. State legislators have told me that, especially ones in the suburbs. In the city, maybe you can hide a little bit. Nobody really knows who you are, Jewel. But, you know, out in the suburbs, I think that that's a much bigger issue for a lot of Democrats. And you know, they're very concerned that by voting for some sort of tax increase, they're going to get hammered. And Bruce Rauner has made it very clear that he's going to do that lots. You know, he's been running campaign commercials already. The Illinois GOP has been doing auto dial calls to threaten people, threaten legislators. You know, they'll have a series of auto dial calls that go into a district, targeted district, in order to kind of threaten somebody. So the idea that politics isn't constantly present is false. You know, Bruce Rauner has made this into a constant campaign. And so when you get into these situations where you want somebody to be able to take a risk, well, what they're thinking about is, well, you know, last month, actually, somebody was kind of messing with me back in my district. So that's something that they're constantly thinking about.
So do they think that there's less risk in inaction? The idea that, hey, we didn't do anything.
Sure.
We didn't pass any taxes.
Absolutely.
We didn't do our jobs.
You know,
so don't bother me in the Jewel.
This you know, listen, this sounds really horrible, but and I apologize to you, listener, for saying this, but there is a maxim among people in politics, which is voters only remember the last horrible thing that happened. And that's usually tax cuts or tax increases. And voters will remember a tax increase.
You don't have to look as far as Pat Quinn.
Yeah.
I mean, Quinn, they hung that around him, the idea of an income tax increase, and he lost by a very small margin, but in a Democratic state with Democratic both the House and Senate.
Listeners, take this into heart, which is that, you know, typically people don't really think about the global picture of things when they go into the voting booth. They think about the thing that ticks them off the most.
Mike Fouché from the Daily Line breaking down today's action and inaction in Springfield.
Today's inaction in Springfield.
Let's take a break. We'll come back. We'll continue the conversation. Stay with us. It's a download here at 720 WGN. Justin
Gottman.
Optimistic Mike Fouché.
Yeah, woo, yeah.
The Daily Line joins us every Wednesday. We're talking about Springfield and what happened today or didn't happen in Springfield. All right, so let's get to this idea that, you know, Eric Zorn had a great piece in the Tribune today about how it's kind of a myth, and everybody knows it, that spending is out of control for state government, meaning that, you know,
Illinois has one of the lowest per capita costs of state government. We have a smaller state government than we've had since, I think, the 1950s.
So who, when a governor gets on in front of a microphone or gets on this radio station or gets on TV with duct tape and flannel shirts and says, we got to stop wasting taxpayers' money. We need to stop the reckless spending in Springfield. What's he talking about?
It's not clear. And part of it is that he has never actually outlined exactly what it is that he means by overspending. I mean, the truth is that if not only is Illinois' state government smaller than it's ever been before, but if we actually reduced our prison population to the size it was in the 1950s, it would be unbelievably small because one of the largest state government groups are prison guards. So you know, I don't know where you go at this point. And it has been, it's very frustrating with Rauner's rhetoric. But, you know, another part is that it's very, very, because of this constant talk of what, you know, we need to cut, we need to cut, mm-hmm. we need to cut. You know, once upon a time, I used to be a political consultant, and I'd look at a lot of polling. And the thing that you always see, certainly in the top three, oftentimes in the number one spot, is taxes. And everybody wants to talk about taxes being cut. And everybody's very interested in there being more cuts in taxes and the government should be smaller. So it's an easy place for state legislators and politicians to go. I'm going to cut government. I'm going to cut government waste. It's very, very hard because right. this is lodged into voters' minds, and it really is. It's very, very hard for a legislator or any politician to really be able to convince voters that, well, actually, our government is pretty small.
Right.
So maybe what we ought to be doing is figuring out how to pay things.
There's no doubt about it that the government is small. The big part of it, and what is the worst in the country, is our debt to the pension system.
Right.
Amazing amount
right.
of recklessness
right.
and terrible government
yeah.
when it came to bypassing
yeah.
or skipping over payments. And this is, I mean, it's bipartisan in a way that I know that this will be something that is always blamed on Democrats, but this whole idea of skipping payments started with Governor Edgar in the 90s.
And this is a tremendous problem, and Illinois has not taken any steps forward. And the fight that we're having here today is not about being able to pay our backlog of bills or not about being able to pay down our pension. The fight that we're having today is how do we keep schools open? How do we keep the state government open on an operating annual basis? The really big questions we haven't even addressed.
Okay. So I want to get at the Democrats too, because this drives me crazy. And there seemed to be a time in government where, and this is politics played out, that there were deadlines. You and I have deadlines in our job. We got to do the show every night. There are things that are just they're hard and fast. You can't get loose with it. At what point did it used to be the 12th hour, or the 11th hour, and there'd be deals cut and compromises? Oh, you didn't get what you wanted, but you tried. But there was, at the time it was midnight on the day, May 31st, there was a budget in place. Somewhere along the line, the Democrats, under the direction and leadership of Mike Madigan, recognized that they didn't mean anything. Those deadlines
yeah.
didn't mean anything. We could do it tomorrow. We don't have to
yeah.
do it at all.
Well,
and I just feel
yeah.
like that, to me, is something that I think everybody who's listening right now is trying to gather how that's possible and how that's not against the law.
Well, truthfully, it's not against the law because it's just the rules.
All right.
But I mean, truthfully, these extended sessions are very onerous for legislators. A lot of them aren't full time. They have other jobs. They do other things. You know, they're school superintendents, they're attorneys, they're real estate agents, they're, you know, whatever you might come up with. And being stuck in Springfield means that they're not earning money at their regular job. And the amount of money that they get, you know, they get a per diem, but the per diem is, you know, I think it's like, you know, $180 or something like that, which really
okay.
is not a lot of money once you pay for your hotel
okay, well,
and everything
else.
Okay,
don't take the job.
Well,
what do you want me to say?
Actually,
why are you...
That actually is the case, which is that it's become very hard for both Democrats and Republicans to recruit good, high-quality candidates.
We don't pay these people enough, so that's why they can't get the job done?
Well, you know, the job, you know, it sounds great, but, you know, I think the starting salary for a state legislator is like $48,000. And for a lot of people,
right.
you know, $48,000, if you're 40-something years old, you could probably earn money doing something else.
All right, don't make me turn into John McLaughlin here. Wrong!
Right.
Don't care!
The larger thing, though, is that Democrats really did chicken out in being able to raise taxes. Mike Madigan allowed a income tax increase that had been passed under Governor Quinn to expire. And that's when he had an opportunity. He could have extended it before the election in 2014.
But he did that for political reasons, too.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And so we wouldn't be in the mess that we're in today if Mike Madigan hadn't passed that again.
Okay, so here comes... There's not going to be a budget. Not until the 2018 gubernatorial election, which is crazy to think about.
After, well... Maybe. I mean, we'll see.
Okay, well, it'll be the primary will be before the
yeah.
spring session or during the spring session.
Well, there'll be a veto session. They could potentially do something during the veto session. But yes, in November and December.
What does Governor Rauner...
And Madigan has said that they're going to stay in continuous session through June.
Oh,
so
well,
there might be something passed. But the problem, though, is that in order to pass something, both the House and the Senate have to have a three-fifths vote. So it's harder to pass with a three-fifths vote than it is a simple majority. You have to get more votes.
Right.
So, you know, there is still a possibility of something happening.
What does Governor Rauner run on as accomplishments in his first term as governor?
Well, I mean, I'm wondering how many people that are listening to this are from, you know, downstate Illinois. I mean, I know that Governor Rauner is extraordinarily popular south of I-80. And largely because a lot of people in the southern part of the state feel like state government has been doing too much for the city of Chicago for too long. And Rauner spends a lot of time talking about how the city of Chicago has been bailed out by the state and bailed out by the state.
Okay.
And it's not taking responsibility for its own actions. I think there's a lot of people that feel like Rauner is finally a truth teller.
Okay, so then what do the Democrats and Mike Madigan, what are they, Pritzker, Kennedy, this, what do they run on?
Irresponsibility, you know, no state government in the country has gone this long without a budget, and we have charities and all kinds of other things closing, you know, stuff that you and I have talked about. I think that it's going to become really interesting because those arguments, we're going to hear about them over the summer of 2018 with whoever the two candidates are, and then probably by the time we get to, you know, the fall, it's mostly going to be a personality contest, particularly if what a lot of Democrats are hoping is that Pritzker will become the nominee. A lot of establishment Democrats are hoping that. I should correct myself. And if Pritzker, one billionaire versus Rauner, another billionaire, are bashing each other, you know, my God. We're going to go right past everything that's important and get to the personality stuff.
Mike Fouché from the Daily Line joins us every Wednesday. This Wednesday, very optimistic.
I am. This is great. Illinois is a wonderful place.
Good to see you. Welcome back to the Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, my next guest, musical legend, and that's not hyperbole. Mike Watt is considered to be one of the best punk rock bass players of all time and one of the strongest voices that's ever represented the musical form. Watt rose to prominence with his band, the Minutemen, a trio out of San Pedro, California. The band was an integral part of the California punk community and was known for their quick, econo-sized songs like this great track, Corona. That track was also used as a theme song for the MTV show Jackass. The Minutemen's career was tragically cut short in 1985 when guitarist Dee Boone died in a car accident. The band broke up and Watt moved on to start Firehose. He also had a tremendous solo career. He's collaborated with pretty much every big name in alternative music, and he's even played bass in the reunion for the Stooges. Mike Watt is back in town touring with the Meat Puppets. The bass player and spiritual leader of American punk rock is in studio with me tonight at the big table. Mike Watt, thanks for being here.
Justin, thanks for having me aboard. Dee Boone wrote that song, Corona. They wrote the better ones. But
how? I mean, when you think about coming through Chicago, I mean, you have so many memories of coming through this
area. I was conceived in this town. There's a boot camp, right, Lakeshore, where the sailors.
Yeah, right.
And my ma, she's Wyoming, but the coal town shut down, so they moved to Peoria. And a big, people don't know on the port and starboard sides that the big town for the Midwest is here.
Yeah.
So she moves here, and the Soviets came into Hungary. So there was refugees, and there was a dance at a YMCA benefit, and that's where they met. And she gave me the address when I was helping. I did 125 months with the Stooges, and they recorded an album here with Mr. Albini, Electrical Audio.
Of course, yeah, yeah.
He let me use his bicycle. I went to that address, and I got her on the leash. Hey, Ma, there it is. Hey, Michael Watt, you was conceived there. Now, I was born in Virginia, but 9 years old, I go to California because it's closer to Vietnam.
I mean, I thought it would all be stories about playing Metro or whatever, but I guess that story's even better.
That's a lot of gigs there.
Well, I mean, Chicago is
all
known.
My gigs were there for many years.
Yeah.
There was one crazy one in something called the West End. An ex-cop only, he waved his gun and tore up. They told me he's on a 3-day chocho binge and tore up the thing. Yeah. But they were all there. Joe Shanahan,
yeah.
Right?
But,
yeah.
I mean, you just mentioned Steve Albini. I mean, Chicago has such a rich punk rock history here.
Yeah.
I mean, do you recognize that? I mean, for what Chicago?
Yeah, big time. Big time. It's called Big Shoulders, right? And that's true, especially when you tour. You know, I'm kind of from before the movement, vaudeville and working the towns. And this is an important, I think that's why it even got going. It's a hub. The Great Lakes probably was a big thing.
Yeah, right.
You know, the Erie Canal, Andy Jackson hated it, right? The first big public works. But it put the Atlantic Ocean, it connected the whole country. And that's what I kind of do. I work the towns.
Yeah.
And this is the big center daddy. Like there's a port one in SoCal, right? And then there's the Apple.
Let's go back to the 80s. Let's and even the late 70s. The Minutemen and you think all the bands that we hear now, punk rock bands, the seminal bands of that everyone listening tonight knows, they'll say, you know what? And who inspired me? The Minutemen. So I have a question for you, Mike.
Yeah.
Who inspired you guys? Who were the bands you were listening to when the Minutemen started?
You know, because we're 70s punk, so we're a little before the hardcore. Not like we're better. It's just the way the hand was dealt. We graduated high school in 76. And we're from arena rock, right? Our first, me and D Boone's first gig is T-Rex. We're 14 and never been in a club. So all we knew was kind of records or something where you sat way in the distance and there was little lights and a lot of Namota smoke kind of covered it and bad sound. I didn't even know what a bass was. His mother puts me on it. It's arena rock bands at first. When I met D Boone, the only rock band he knew was Creedence Clearwater Revival. Which is kind of how I got into flannels, because I looked at the singer's shirt and I thought maybe he'll still like me if I wear those shirts. So Blue Oyster Cult, you know, it was the guys, they were like the most difficult guy we could figure out, because you copied records in those days. You didn't think of music as a way of expressing yourself. It's something you did with your friend, like building models.
Right.
But you go to a club. I remember the first punk gig, we saw the Bags in Hollywood, West Hollywood, the whiskey. First thing that fell out of my mouth, we can do that. And then we started seeing the bands, and yeah, we had favorites, you know, the Germs, Still Bags, X. I mean, some of these bands didn't even have guitars, you know. It was kind of reactionary.
Yeah.
And the way I mean reactionary is like we come from arena rock and we want to.
Right.
Now, serving with the Stooges, I understand in the 60s there was a huge garage scene and independent labels and clubs. But this weird thing came in the 70s, right? The Nuremberg Rally's way of doing gigs. And
big,
we all like the one thing,
right,
and we're all
right.
Small. And it wasn't that empowering, especially with the bass guitar overseas. Jack Bruce, Scotland, and England, they weren't afraid to put the bass loud on the record so I could hear it. John Entwistle, even guys like Pete Quaife or Chaz Chandler, you know, Animals and Kinks, Geezer Butler. Over on this side, R&B and Motown. James Jamerson, incredible inspiration for me. Larry Graham. You know, in Sly's band.
Yeah.
And part of this was in D. Boone, you know, a lot of people think it was words. And D. Boone called that thinking out loud. He said the politics of how we put the band together. There was a hierarchy with arena rock. The guitar and singers ran in.
Yeah.
The other guys were like right field in Little League, you know, where nobody hits the ball. D. Boone wanted to bring us in.
Right.
So from the brothers doing the little trebly rhythm guitar, making room for the bass.
I have so many questions about the bass because I've read so much about your beginning days of trying to figure out the instrument, you know.
Had no idea.
Even tuning was
we thought down on the corner, if you played it and it sounded right, you were in tune. But we didn't know you're down in a corner had to be the other dudes. So we thought some dudes like loose strings, liked it tight.
Right,
some guys liked it loose because we couldn't hear. The music's more accessible now. It was like kind of a hidden thing in those days.
But you hear this all the time, especially when you talk about bass players in punk music. They will learn four chords they have to play, and they'll play it as fast and as furious as they possibly can.
Yeah.
What I love about your play, and the Minutemen and even Firehose, everything in between, is there is rhythm to it. There is a soul to it. You can hear that Sly or the Motown kind of vibe on it. It's essentially a different kind of bass than punk music is used to.
Well, a lot of them guys that came up right then started playing. I was a little polluted. That's what we thought at first. Look, Justin, I got to tell you, we really thought it was stupid. We spent all them years never writing a song, never using music for expression. And these guys just learning, they weren't afraid. They were doing it in public. They were taking turns. You know, Pat Smear would be standing next to you after they got done. It wasn't arena rock, man.
It was just a whole nother thing.
It was a very empowering thing. Like, come on. Understand, we're boys in the 60s. In the TV, we're seeing people in the street. You know, there's this free speech and civil right and the war. Mm-hmm. By the 70s come, it was all over, you know? And I think it stuck us. So this little weird movement, and there must have been 200 of them that all meet up in Hollywood, right? So you understand, SoCal, it's 150 towns. You fly over, you think it's one, but it ain't. We don't know each other. Right. The valley, the harbor. But we didn't know each other. We didn't know anything. But that was kind of neat. The one thing that kept us in common, Stooges.
Really? Stooges did.
That's what everyone knew. That was lingua franca.
Oh, interesting. Mike Watts, my guest in studio, the legendary bass player for the Minutemen, Firehose, of course, his solo career, also playing with the Stooges. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back. We'll continue our conversation. Mike Watts in studio. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Coffin. My guest in studio, Mike Watt, the legendary bass player for the Minutemen, Firehose, his solo career, the Stooges. I mean, you collaborated with so many different musicians. I mean, you play on so many different records.
You know the politics of bass. You look good making the other cats look good. I like those pumps.
That's it, right?
And, or look at it this way. You're glue. And what's glue with nothing to stick to? A puddle. And, you know, I learned this by doing it with my friend. You know, music, I was not a musician. I just wanted to be with him.
Yeah.
And then this scene was open enough to let...
Do you still see... we're talking 30, 35 years in the business now.
The racket.
Do you consider yourself a musician, or are you still a revolutionary?
I got a union card for many years, AFM Local 47. Yeah, I've learned things about the music, but the way I got into it was very personal. I tell you, I feel really part of vaudeville tradition, working rooms, and... my hustle is bass, and even if it's my band, I'm behind them, backing them up. I'm really grateful to D. Boone's mom because I didn't pick it.
And I think about it, too, because you guys, as you talked about, you watch people just get up there and do it.
Yeah, it was very
important. And it took a while for you guys to figure it out, but when you did and you started to make music, you're one of those bands that in the time was very influential, but your influence grew even after you were gone. You know, as you moved on to other bands and other solo careers, the Minutemen became bigger and bigger and bigger. To this day, where people think will say they'll get up on stage and accept an award and say, "I want to thank the Minutemen." Yeah. Talk about that.
I think the story of D. Boone, tragic. You know, we lost him young, and I think D. Boone, the way I saw it, he was like potential. You know, he said you didn't have to look like something. You didn't have to. It was never a style of music to us. Yeah, it was more of a state of mind.
Right.
And I think D. Boone showed that, you know. You want to get your guitar, your drummer, your bass, your synthesizer, or your microphone, and go do it wherever you came from, wherever. A lot of stuff, you know, it's not where you're from, it's where you're at, Rakim said, right? And he's so right in a way. A lot of that stuff we don't choose. We're dealt a hand. Even D. Boone... his work ethic was so intense, and I think that got on people. Also, this afraid not to sound strange, that the little songs, mm-hmm. I got it from an England band called Wire. The idea of putting pop right. group with the pop group, they put Beefheart with Funkadelic. Why mm-hmm. Yeah, the bands overseas we never saw, we only knew them by records, they were a big influence too. Even more abstract because you didn't see it happen. It was
they
just sounds.
The Econo sound.
The sounds.
Yeah, right.
But we still thought, if you're going to be part of this movement, you got to bring something to it. And I think that's what D. Boone said. Because, look, we're born all different. You can look at all the thumb. But at the same time, we have so much in common. So that's dangling duality. Everybody's had something in school with getting picked on for some not fitting in. You know, you hear the worst word in my knowledge is called normal. Because what is normal? It means relative to the sitch, right? That can be so dangerous. And a man... or a woman, somebody stands up like Dee Boone, I think that resonates in people.
Were you ready for that? I mean, as
no, I just wanted to be him, with him. I was scared so bad, but you were on stage with him. It was like Ig, the bow of the boat. I really compare their work ethics. Yeah. When it came time to play, Dee Boone didn't think big time like he was better than other people and stuff, but now it's time for me to play the guitar and sing. And I'm going to let you know what's going on up here. And,
were you afraid to express yourself politically, to express yourself, to be a part of a revolution?
No, because of that 60s
okay?
stuff.
You were okay with that?
I think we came out of a 60s tradition, right. Even though we were boys. I'm born in 57. And no, we are, a farmer would tell you, if you want a good crop, use a lot of manure. So we came out of, the country had to deal with stuff. It still has to deal with stuff, right?
Right,
the thing ain't done, and we're a work in progress.
I was reading an article, I think it was back in 2004, and this was right around, it was right after 9/11, George W. Bush. And you talked about how a lot of kids were essentially trying to figure out, they couldn't figure out that they were being hustled.
Yeah,
that's where punk music, that's where the punk aesthetic comes from, is how do you express yourself? Where do you go when you feel like you're being scammed, where you feel like you're being hustled? This was 2004, but it applies today. It applies in 2007. It applies back in 1977. I mean, it applies. I mean, that's an ethos. That's sort of almost a philosophy for punk.
Things get co-opted. I mean, Pat Boone sold many more little Tutti Frutti's than Little Richard. But, you know, he said his version was for the bedroom and maybe Pat's was for the living room. People are running hustles, you know, and then there's other people who are really trying to use arts as a fabric to connect, you know, like an interesting flannel.
All them threads, right?
That's the way I look at it. I think that's why there's more than one band.
Well, I mean, the punk aesthetic, the concept of we're not heard. Or we want to find a way to express ourselves. And it always seems to...
We don't fit in, so why not a parallel universe?
Right.
At the end of the day is the humanity that you share, the cat on the street. What's it going to be? I got to tell you, this tour, I can't believe the driving. And I've everywhere. And the country's angry.
Well, I want to talk... I mean, it's amazing to me you're driving everywhere. I mean...
Well, Scotty ain't got the transporter room fixed yet.
Mike Watt, my guest in studio. You know, it's amazing to think about the fact that you've had such a tremendous career working with such tremendous musicians. And you mentioned right at the beginning of this segment about the bass being the glue.
Yeah.
As a collaborator, as someone who can jump into other people's music or work really quick, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if in a day's time we find out Mike Watt's working with another musician. You know, what is your philosophy when it comes to working with other musicians as a bass player? Is there a certain thing that has to be there before you decide to work with somebody?
Well, one thing is, you know, all these bad new days, right? Well, the internet can let you collaborate with people like you could never do in the good old days.
Just because you can send stuff back.
That's right, man. Right. I've made albums with guys I've never even met. Here's some sounds. What you wanna? And here's my basic thing. It's the main point of my third opera. Life's for learning. Just stay a student. And one way to really lame it out is think you know it all.
Yeah.
And then you're in big trouble.
Then you're in trouble, right?
See, so everybody's got something to teach you. And the funny thing about bass is the physics, because we got real big wavelengths. So the more notes you play, the littler you get. So it's always a search for the right notes. That means some guy just learning or a woman learning how to play can write a happening bass line. I was really happy to see Stanley Clarke in an interview. He said, anybody can do a bass solo. It's writing a good bass line.
Yeah, right.
That's Stanley Clarke.
That's Stanley Clarke,
When he was a younger man, Atlantic Records or somebody set him up with Charles Mingus. And Charles Mingus wanted to show him, take the A-train.
Wow. I don't need to learn
take the A-train. I don't think he would be saying that now. And that's what that means. He's in learning mode. Stanley Clarke is incredible, a virtuoso.
Yeah.
So that's what I'm looking for. I'm looking for a situation where I'm in the classroom. Remember when we're younger, finally we're going to graduate? No, don't think that, because it's actually a paradigm for the whole dealio.
Mike Watt, my guest in studio, the longtime legendary punk rock bass player of the Minutemen, Firehose, his own stuff, of course. He's just in town with the Meat Puppets. We'll talk more with Mike Watt right after the news here on The Download on The Big Table. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Coffin. My guest in studio, Mike Watt, the legendary punk rock bass player, Minutemen, Firehose, The Stooges, his own work, of course. You see him
Jay Maskus, Portal for Pirates.
I mean, really, we go I don't have enough time to list.
No,
all
but
the
I toured with him, guys, yeah. And that's the first time I really helped guys by touring with him. And you learn the way other people tour.
Learn stuff? I mean, about touring from with some of the more contemporary musicians?
Yeah, you learn that maybe your way ain't the only way. And Jammy Cano is maybe not for everybody. Like, even with the Meat Puppets this tour, they had 3 days off. Right, vaudeville. When you ain't playing, you're paying.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. You know what I mean? You can get Mr. Ibsen, right? Enemy of the People. You can get a little full of yourself. You got to watch out.
Is there a time that you think, I mean, here you are, you're driving through. I mean, you're driving in a van. Is there a time where you
kind of like,
do you slow down? Do you change your, as you learn more about being a musician, do you change the way you approach
music? You do get less younger. We get rid of the old word, right? There's more younger and less younger.
Right.
So your body, you got to adjust. I remember I did the 71 gigs, 56 in a row. I don't think I could do that now. So maybe they're littler chunks. Being California, it's been a long time from Virginia, right? So maybe springtime and fall.
Yeah, right.
I'll do a summer maybe, but winter, ice, snow. You know what I mean? You pick your fights. I think you're a little smarter about picking your fights.
You have such an attachment to the music and to your instrument. There was a well-documented case where you got sick in the 2000 where you were
and that's where
infection.
I got my second opera out.
Yeah, right. I mean, but it was a moment where you were close to death.
Yeah.
You weren't able to... Even after the fact, you had to retrain yourself to play the bass. You had to retrain yourself to use your hands.
But what happened because of that? Yeah, I didn't play for 6 months. It's the first time I had to stop playing since Steve Boone's mom put me on bass because it's the tubes. And I lost it. I thought it was like the bike ride thing, you know? I had no rhythm. I had no strength. So I start practicing the Stooges, the first two albums, over and over again. And it came back. And who knows, you know, that calling 3 years later from Ig in Tallahassee, Bonnie says, you're the man. He said, would you wear a T-shirt instead of a flannel? I said, yeah, no worry. I said, that's John Fogerty's idea anyway. I said, what about Levi and Converse?
Yeah.
He says, that's strong.
That's okay.
Yeah, that's strong. But I couldn't believe this, you know.
Right. What a full circle to think that the Stooges connected the punk rock community in California and New York to it being the way that you got
notice
back in the
base. Out of the Midwest, though. The tastemakers ain't always.
Yeah, right.
Right? That's an important lesson to learn there.
Of course, I should know that being in Chicago.
I know, I know. I just want to give credit where credit's due. There's something about, you know, not so front. I like the Midwest thing. This is what I mean. Like Missouri, it says, show me, right? You got to show me.
Right.
There's nothing wrong with that.
For you, I mean, music's obviously your way of your life. I mean, and you've become not only a musician, but a spokesperson. You've been, in a way, a lecturer in the way that you talk about the aesthetics of punk rock. And you talk about...
Because I don't want to die. I don't want to be a museum piece. It's a way of doing things. I come from that tradition. I don't want it to die. So I talk about it. And notice I don't tell you how to do it. Because I think everybody's got their way. There's, I got a radio show.
Of course. Yeah.
Right? The Waffle Pedro show.
Back in Pedro, right?
Right. And they're all archived and stuff. And I feel it's a debt. I owe the movement because I don't play Mersch stuff. It's stuff that's happening, right? I start everyone with the John Coltrane song. But he said something. He said, music people are after some kind of truth. And I like that. And that's what I try to get through with the movement.
What's your truth? What are you after?
Some kind of truth. I side with Mr. Coltrane.
Right.
No, I mean is like it's hard to pin the nail, but I do think there's something about the humanity that you can share with your fellow cat that you meet on the street. And on the other hand, there's a creative, the artistic thing. Raymond Pettibone, big hero of mine. The arts, you know, Debu could paint. He didn't go to the school, but arts have always interested me. The way you can express yourself to get things off. Also, the creative thing, because making life interesting is kind of happening.
Talk about the personal, of course, losing your friend in 1985.
Yeah.
You know, we go back 30 years, 32 years to talk about it, but you still talk about it like he's here today.
Yeah.
His impact on you as a musician, as a friend, as a human being.
Yeah.
Talk about that. Talk about what it means to have him in your life, D. Boone, and also what you keep with you as you continue on this journey to find truth.
Well, he had certain kind of ethics I really admire. He wanted to walk the walk. I just talk the talk, you know what I mean? It seems like a lot of jive back then and the thing us humans always got to deal with. And Yeah, how are we living? How healthy are we? How safe are we? And how can we be creative about this and make it so when you hear that song, mm-hmm. you know it's from him or her or something. He had integrity, you know, and it made big impression. And, you know, I get doubts, but that momentum, there's a momentum from there. I can't tell you, Justin, like, I talk to him. Now, I do ask him things, but he never answers me. I guess he wants me to think about it. I don't know. So he tried his hardest.
Yeah.
He tried his hardest and didn't want to be jived, didn't want to get something over on somebody. That if you dug it, okay, give me another shot.
How much does it mean to you that 32 years later,
yeah,
he's continued to be talked about? People are writing about him. They're covering music. They're looking at him as a source of inspiration. We're talking about him. Yeah. What does it mean to you that his legacy continues?
He made impressions, not just on Watt, although he made a big one on Watt. I'm very grateful for people. They didn't put him in a glass box somewhere. They make him part of life. You hear people talk like, yeah, what would he do? What would he do? Like, I think about that. Yeah, what would you do? All the time, about all kinds of things. So that's how you keep them here mm-hmm. and not away. You know, a dynamic, things for things to live, because we only got, right, our shift's only so long, right? And we got to let the next one come on. There was the last one that we draw on. Being in the dynamic, that's a trip. And that's something you could do. Losing people's heart.
Yeah.
Brother Chris.
Yeah. You guys shared a label?
Yeah. Chris, and I tell you, every time I was with him, it's just beautiful to me. Kind cat, man.
It's a tight community when you talk about music and musicians. And you could tell by the emotion that we're hearing right now. You know, for you, as you just mentioned, you know, it's somebody's shift, then it's your shift, then it's another shift. You have found a way to carve a little spot out in the history of punk rock music and music in general.
Well, thank you.
People will know Mike Watt
thank
for D. generations.
Boone. Thanks, George Hurley.
But, I mean, when you think about that, and you think about all the things we've been talking about in this hour, the idea that people will remember you as well.
Well, I better live up to it. I better not, like, let them down, you know?
What does it mean to you? I mean, you just came in from Cleveland. I mean, you're on the road. You get back in the van. I mean, what does it mean to you that
tomorrow's
you can
St.
stop?
Louis.
Tomorrow's that's what it means.
Double Nichols Freeway, right? I-55.
Right.
It's all connected, Justin. You know what I mean? It's almost like a big rock and the sculptor sees the piece. He's just got to chip away the stuff. That's the way life is for me. But I better not let people down. You know, that's sometimes I get a little short, like when they're taking pictures, take too long. And I'm like, oh, man, is this guy the little Lord Fauntleroy? Or what's this about? You know, I don't want to let people down.
Right.
Because you said there are a lot of nice things about me. I want to live up to it. Go down swinging, you know, not be jive.
Awesome to talk to you, Mike. Mike Watt, the bass player, longtime legendary punk rock bass player, Minutemen, Firehose, Stooges, his own records, and we can name 6,000 other projects that you've been involved in.
Only 6,000 more.
and here's the 6,000 more. Mike, thanks for being my guest at the Big Table. Appreciate it.
Thanks so much, Jess.
Combo, Mike Watt. I read so much on Mike Watt in getting ready for that interview about his career and about his politics, his passion. It's interesting, too, because the two things that every interviewer pulls out is one, that he's still in a van going around the country. And Mike Watt, of course, 35 years of playing punk rock bass. He also sells his own T-shirts, meaning the T-shirts at the merch table. For years, he'd come out and be the guy who sells the T-shirts. Yeah, it's like a little trivia. Like, that's what people who listen to Mike Watt's music, they know he'll be out there at the table selling the merch. That's pretty unique.
Yeah.
It's usually a friend. If it's a Econo kind of band, it's the friend.
Right, because you would think that if you want to move merch, you got to keep the line moving. But everybody's going to want to talk to Mike Watt, and he seems like a guy that wants to talk to everybody. Yeah. He probably sells two T-shirts every night because he's talking so much.
But he also is a great—I don't want to call it a gimmick, but a great thing to do. I mean, people came to see your show. You just sweated it out. You just did an hour 15. You blew the roof off the place. People love it, and they come out in the lobby, and you're going, $10. $10 for the Minutemen T-shirt. $10 fire hose. It reminds me a lot of Penn and Teller. Penn and Teller, if you've ever seen a Penn and Teller show, I love those guys. And we stole it. We stole that same concept for Schadenfreude, the show that I did. They would run their last bit they would do. They'd say, thank you very much, and the lights would go on. And they would book down the center of the aisle. And when you would actually walk out, they do it in Vegas, and they did it in Chicago on the tour.
Yeah.
When you walk out, they shake your hand and they walk out like, thanks for coming.
Mm-hmm.
And it would be the same thing because I've seen them a couple of times and there'd always inevitably be a traffic jam because someone would want to spend too much time talking to them and they were blocking the door essentially with people trying to get by. And no one really wanted to miss their opportunity to be greeted by Penn and or Teller.
Yeah.
There's one person going, I love you, I saw you a long time ago. Right?
Oh, yeah.
But we did the same thing. I loved it. It was a great, because at the end of the day, if you're doing shows Econo style, and with that, you know, like stripped down, not a lot of pretension, not a big stage show, not a lot of design. You're at the door taking money. You go play the instrument. You come back. You're at the merch table. You get in the van. You go.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the spirit and mm-hmm. and the success of bands like Minutemen, bands like Firehose. And a lot of artists. I mean, I think of a lot of theater artists are like that. But sketch comedy is the same way, improv. And with Schadenfreude, back in the day when we were at the Heartland Studio in 1999, we did the same concept. Mark would take the money. He'd get up on stage. We would perform our heart out for an hour. And at the end of the show, there was this bit where I would end up being very sort of like I don't even want to explain it, but the idea being that, you know, I was messy, right? I had fake blood that was made out of Cairo syrup
mm-hmm.
on me in my body. And so it is even more of a spectacle that I would run around the theater, a little theater through the alley in Rogers Park with my bare feet, essentially, because I was down to my skivvies at this point. And I would stand at the door and people would walk out and I would be bloody in just these sort of boy shorts with nothing else. And I'd be like, thanks for coming. I really appreciate you guys coming. That was the bit. So everyone would come out and be like, hey, 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 hey. And I'd be like, thank you so much. Thanks, guys. And I'd give everybody a fist bump on the way out because I was sticky. And so, yeah, I mean.
That's a good bit.
Yeah. But, I mean, there's something to this idea, this Econo idea that the artists, when they're done, they don't go backstage. It's always funny because I was taught at Second City that you never, even before and after, that as a performer, you're not seen. You do your show and then you're out until mm-hmm. you're dressed and you're on your way out. Especially before a show. Man, they would just drill down the professors and the people, instructors and the directors at Second City, that you are not to be seen before a show starts. Like, and you see this a lot with bands, you know, and it's usually a sign of an amateur when the band, the guitar player is up there goofing around on the stage before they're called out. You never see bands do that. But there's this unwritten rule in performance, and this is also in sketch comedy, that you are not seen. You want the first time that you're seen by your friends, your family, the people who came to the show, whatever, to be when the lights are on and you're about to give your line. And I really enjoyed messing with that. I enjoy the experience in the lobby. I enjoy the experience after.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the Jam Econo movement that Mike Watt was just talking about enjoys it too. This idea that there is no break between the performers and the performance and the people that are in the room. We don't have to be so pretentious that, you know, first time you see me, I'm in a suit and I'm like, hello. And
yeah.
I know everybody in the audience at this point. And if I don't, I'd like to. You came to my show.
That was like one of the first things I realized when you growing up and you're going to concerts and you go from, you know, the Allstate Arena seeing, you know, Van Halen and, you know, the arena rock bands, Foreigner and what have you, going to Metro and Lounge Acts, even like the bars where you're like, oh my God, there's the guy from the headlining band sitting at the bar
having
a drink. They're just like they're with you in the bar.
Yeah, right.
And then they walk past you to go to get to the stage as opposed to, you know, like, yeah, never seeing them and then coming out. And
I'm sure at a certain point, you see this a lot with, you know, the bigger acts. They don't want to do that because they're bothered before a show or they're just over it. So they go backstage and you can't see them until. I saw a picture of Mike Watt on stage with the Meat Puppets. And it was it was like nine guys on stage, wires everywhere. They're just like kind of looking at each other. It looked like a jam session from, you know, rural Missouri. But it was the punk rock guys of the Minutemen and other places, you know, and it was, but there was a lack of pretension to it. It wasn't, you know, he doesn't dress up in the, you know, the outfit.
No,
he doesn't. You know, I got to get my black jeans and my black t-shirt so you can see my tattoos.
Yeah,
and I'm going to pretend like I'm 25. He's got his Columbia yellow jacket
yeah,
on.
He looks like a dad.
Yeah,
kind
he looks
of.
Like a dad. He does. Yeah. And he no pretension to it. He's like, that's who I am, and I'm going to play. And there's something really great about that. Right.
I think like if I was a musician, I would, you know, I'd come out and play and then I would go into the back to sign the merch, probably just so I can meet a lady.
Yeah.
But ladies never talk to you. It's always the dudes that want to talk to you. It's a line full. You go to these things where you see people doing the meet and greet. It's always a line full of dudes. There's never a girl that's like sitting in line wanting to meet you.
That's the name of my new sketch comedy show, A Line Full of Dudes. That's true, right? But, I mean, if you're Minutemen, right, and you yet have a following that's thousands and thousands of people on purpose, I mean, you're playing every night different places, you just haven't given your art the chance to breathe in the way that you're playing every single night.
Yeah.
You know, I guess there's service in the idea of being able to greet your fans, greet the people that came out, and give them an experience in which they not only were fans, but they were part of a community, and that community is cool with hanging out after the fact in the lobby, in that form. I've always thought, I mean, some of the great comedians do that, stand-up comedians do that. And it's fun to be in a, you kind of see it on some of the shows that are about stand-up comedy right now, Crashing and others, where people are at the bar.
Yeah.
They're there. You go to a show in Chicago, Laugh Factory, or maybe at Zany's or other places, they're there. They did the show. They're now drinking with you.
I think I have a stream of pictures in my phone of people that have been at Zany. You know, like your Hannibal Buress's, your Chris Hardwick's, your Mark Maron's that, you know, they all, right, yeah, they come right out and like they talk, they wait in line to say hi or right, sign something, right, take a picture or whatever. Yeah. One of my most famous meet and greets was with there's a band called the Sugar Cubes back
course,
in the late
yeah.
80s, early 90s. Bjork, yeah, Bjork, you know,
right,
was the
right
singer. And she was her and like the dude in the band were working the merch table. And I bought a shirt. They signed it. And I had that shirt for like 30 years.
That's a good shirt to have.
Yeah.
And that came in handy, I'll bet. I mean, it says I'm into indie rock and I'm also sensitive. You know, if you got a Sugar Cubes, if you put a Sugar Cubes shirt on, like it's a little bit off the beaten path, you know, and you're like, oh, yeah, I like the Sugar Cubes, too. This guy's real sensitive.
But, yeah, I don't know. Right when, you know, the swap meet's taken off, when I got, you know, something of real value that somebody might want, you know, I can't find
that
it for.
That should be the first one tonight. We'll ask Greg, what's a Sugar Cubes shirt go for? That's a great Sugar Cubes, man. I can't remember the name of the record, but they had a green cover on the.
Yeah,
oh,
green with
record.
Birthday. Yeah. That was the big hit. Yeah.
Yeah. What happened to Bjork? She just kind of did her thing. She's in art now.
Yeah, I think she does weird stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. I love that she's working the merch. That should be a new segment, though. What's your best lobby experience, right? We should do a whole segment with the Download Faithful about what's your best lobby experience? Who did you approach? I feel like I did. I remember going to an in-store. Maybe it was at the outlet mall? The Gurney.
Gurney Mills, yeah.
If it wasn't there, it was another mall where I got to meet Toad the Wet Sprocket. And there was nobody else there. Like, it was just me and my buddy, and so we got to hang out a little bit and, like, talk to them. But we had nothing to say, right?
Right.
Oh, my God, there's nobody here. This is crazy. What's up, guys? Hey, how's it going?
That's what we got.
Can we just hang here? It's like one of my favorite meet and greets was a baseball player. I've told the story before, Bill Buckner, where we went. It was at the high school gym in 1983, 82, whenever he was on the Cubs. And he came out to, you know, is sponsored by the car dealership to come out there. And we all probably through WGN radio at the time. And we all stood in line, you know, it was a long line. And he got up there and he's just like so sick of signing autographs. And my dad goes, "Hey, you know, my son, he doesn't like to tie his shoes. You know, you've got ankle problems. You know what that's like." Buckner's like, "I don't care." It was so embarrassing. Like, I was like 8 years old or whatever, and I was not tying my shoes. And my dad's like, "Hey, Billy, you got bad ankles. You got bad knees. You know what it's like. Tell this kid what's up. Tie his shoes." So dumb. All right. All right, coming up, Michael Hawthorne's going to join us. We're going to talk about the Paris Accord. Why did we – I guess we haven't yet. That's what's going to be the interesting thing. Is yesterday, there was a tweet that just came out in the last hour from President Trump that said, big meeting tomorrow in the Rose Garden, 3 o'clock. Don't be late. Talk about Paris. Make America great.
Climate.
Climate.
Making America great.
Make America great. Does he hashtag that?
It's you know what? I saw the quote. I don't know if
he
hashtagged
it. I gotta see. No, he does not. He all caps it. Yeah. Sorry. That's a different kind of annoying.
that's like loud. Yeah. You know?
There's hashtag annoying and then there's all caps annoying. Both literally annoying.
Well, and then exclamation point, exclamation point, exclamation point.
No, he's got only one. So
oh, really? Oh.
A lot of space. There's a lot of space between. It's a grammatical minefield. The latest Donald Trump tweet. This is Chicago's very own 720 WGN Chicago, WGNRadio.com. If you're an Amazon Echo user, just say play WGN Radio. Like you said, Michael Hawthorne is going to join us right after the news to talk about what it means to pull out of the Paris Agreement. Thanks, Rob. It's Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, big news today, of course, leaked as always. So I should say maybe big news that the United States and the White House is pulling out of the Paris Accord. This was the climate change meeting that all of the developing countries in the world got behind during the Obama administration. Historic to take on climate change. That, of course, it was a big news, and it also was something that President Trump ran on in the campaign to say it was a bad deal. Didn't like that we were having to give money or give away things to the rest of the world and that make America great again, make America first. So today it is rumored that the United States will pull out of that agreement. Also, as you just heard from Rob Martyr, the president is going to be speaking on this topic tomorrow at the Rose Garden, 3 o'clock. He finished his tweet with "Make America Great Again." So we'll find out if that is just a straight all the details that come with an announcement at the Rose Garden in the White House. Joining me now on the line, Michael Hawthorne. He is an investigative reporter with the Chicago Tribune. He focuses on environment and public health. Maybe he can help us understand a little bit more about the Paris Accord and why the United States would want to pull out. Michael, great to have you on the show. Thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate it.
Yeah, great to be with you, Justin.
So let's talk about this. I mean, why don't we set the table in the story about what the Paris Accord is? Why don't we start with what happened and how that all came about?
Well, I think this was something that's been in the works for a long time. Globally, there have been other attempts to try to get a worldwide treaty to essentially hold a lot of countries to certain deadlines to reduce their contributions, basically fossil fuel-related contributions to driving up global temperatures, which then cause, some people call it climate change, some other people call it climate weirdness. That means that, you know, sometimes there's more rain, sometimes there's drought, sometimes it's especially cold. You know, weather changes day to day. The climate is definitely changing over time. Global temperatures are higher than they were a century ago. They're projected to speed up. That change is predicted to speed up. Some people think that the projected changes are a little too dire. Some Right. people think they're not dire enough. So there's a lot of fear that we're going to reach some kind of tipping point where, you know, oceans start rising, glaciers really start melting, sea level rises. And, you know, if you spend the summer or spring in places like coastal Carolina or Florida, some of those places already are dealing with sea level rise and the problems that come with that to some pretty valuable vacation right. property. So they try to put the world on this target. I think it was important in a lot of ways because it got China, which even though you know, historically we as a country have contributed a lot to pollution that's up there in the atmosphere, causing the greenhouse effect. But China now is the number one contributor to that. And they burn a heck of a lot of coal. They've got a very fast-growing economy. They're in many ways where the United States was, you know, at the early 1900s when we were burning a lot of coal and in the middle of the Industrial Revolution. They've also been acting very aggressively on clean energy. And in many ways, we're in a business competition with Chinese companies. And I think that's one of the things that you're going to hear a lot about outside of the screaming and yelling and pointing of fingers in Washington is there are a lot of business opportunities that are happening out there worldwide and here in the United States and here in the state of Illinois and in the Chicago area yeah. that revolve around different types of energy, not coal, not oil. And people are making money that way. So this could potentially affect that in the long run.
Well, Michael, let me ask you this, because it's a non-binding agreement, the idea that it's almost like a handshake deal where all the countries around the world, developing countries, got together, big ones, of course, China and the United States, to sort of, you know, hold each other accountable. That's really what this is, because the United States is, it's up to us to come up with our own individualized plan on how we're going to take this issue on. The Obama administration did that, and there was pretty aggressive standards in what they wanted to see done by 2025, 2030. And that I can understand why President Trump would want to pull back on that. There's a lot of lobbying influences in that regard. But the idea to walk away or to withdraw from something that really is just all of us and sort of having a mental agreement, it's a little bit of a head scratcher to me.
Well, I think that's a great question. And I think it runs against a lot of recent historical precedent, too. It wasn't that long ago during Ronald Reagan's administration that the United States joined a lot of other countries to form what was called and still is called the Montreal Protocol. And that drastically reduced the use of chemicals that were destroying the ozone layer and that protects us from ultraviolet radiation that can cause cancer and all kinds of other problems. And I think it's interesting. A lot of really smart scientists and people who were involved in the Montreal Protocol have noted that at the time that was adopted in the late 1980s, we knew less about the science of ozone depleting chemicals than we do now about climate change. But that didn't stop Reagan from signing on to the Montreal Protocol. And it didn't stop the United States Senate from approving it on an overwhelming bipartisan vote. And there was an op-ed in the Washington Post recently by three former EPA administrators under Republican presidents, both the first President Bush and also Reagan, where they talk about that treaty. And they also talk about the consequences that we could be facing if we don't keep on this aggressive track of trying to reduce climate change pollution, right. Things like glacial melts. They note that Glacier National Park, one of our great national parks when it was established, had 150 active glaciers. Now there's 26. Here in the Chicago area, we're already seeing flooding and basement backups and sewage flowing into the Chicago River and Lake Michigan. That was not supposed to be happening by now, but our infrastructure can't really handle the type of storms we're getting. We're getting these, we're not necessarily getting more rain, but we're getting it in these really intense bursts, and our infrastructure can't handle it. And then you think back not that long ago, 1995, there was this devastating heat wave that killed more than 700 people. And many of those folks were poor and elderly. They couldn't afford air conditioning. Once again, it was the built-in structure, the way the city of Chicago works. It wasn't built to handle events like that. And the scientists that former Mayor Daley hired to kind of look at this and try to help Chicago plan for a future where we have rising global temperatures and weird climate, weather-related things like that. They said we're going to see more of those things in the coming decades. And whether we're prepared for that is a really big question. There's a lot of talk about that, but in an era when the federal government is pulling back on supporting communities like Chicago and supporting states like Illinois, you wonder where the money's going to come from to do that.
Michael Hawthorne's my guest. He's an investigative reporter with the Chicago Tribune with an interest in public health and environment. He's covered a lot of on the idea of climate change and climate weirdness, as you mentioned, global temperatures. You know, the idea, I mean, I'm reading more about what we assume to have happened tomorrow. I mean, the media has been wrong, especially when it comes to leaks. And it's been interesting and see what.
Yeah,
what,
some people think that maybe people who are against this this Paris Treaty were leaking this to make sure that Trump doesn't change his mind.
Right.
Who knows?
Right. So but it's interesting because, you know, like I mentioned, this is, to me, in my mind, it's a mental handshake to say everybody's got. Everyone is keeping everyone accountable when it comes to the global developing world. In the way that we see climate change from the United States, especially from the government standpoint, this doesn't necessarily mean that we're going to roll back emission standards that were put up. We're seeing, obviously, a huge change of course when it comes to what President Obama did and what President Trump wants to do. But, you know, there is still a lot of power in state level government. When I think of New York and California, even here in Illinois, but you think more about the progressives, California, New York, who have done much, much more with their at the state level to try and curb emissions and deal with the global temperature. So it's not necessarily just because we're pulling out of Paris that the United States is giving up on climate change.
I think that's a great point. And I think when, you know, for listeners who are going to see a lot of hyperbole about this, and whatever the president decides to do tomorrow or decides to announce tomorrow, we already are on a course to have a what some people call a decarbonized world, a world where we're not relying so much on old types of energy like coal and oil. We still rely a lot on oil, but we're relying less and less on coal. And I think it's really interesting. You know, one of the other things that President Trump has targeted is President Obama's what he called the Climate Action Plan. And a couple of years ago, shortly after Obama introduced that, I had gone through the different plans and the different targets that they had set for various states. And Illinois, you know, historically has been a very coal-dependent state. We had a lot of coal mining for many years in southern Illinois. Up until the 90s, most of the coal-fired power plants, including ones in Chicago, burned Illinois coal. We don't have a lot of that anymore. And interestingly enough, that the targets that were set by the Obama Climate Action Plan, Illinois was even a few years ago very close to meeting those. And so were a lot of other states, even some very coal-dependent states. And that's because kind of like what you're talking about. It's not just the Californias and the New Yorks. Look, the state of Indiana, there's a coal plant on Lake Michigan kind of over by where the steel mills are, you know, just east of Gary. the company that owns that power plant, that coal-fired power plant, is shutting that down because there's not a market for that electricity anymore, and it's too expensive to operate.
Right.
Companies are moving toward natural gas, which is not only less expensive, it's also generated here in the United States. It's also cleaner than coal. And so it's a lot of economic decisions are being made that end up having some pretty positive environmental effects. And I don't think that's really going to change much. It might change in some certain industries that might rely on some kind of government assistance or whatnot. But if you read a lot of the economic literature, solar power, wind power, now because of economies of scale and states like Texas and Iowa, red states that have a lot of bipartisan support for clean energy, that's becoming cheaper across the board and can outcompete essentially even natural gas in some cases.
You know, and when I think about it and I hear what you just explained and read more about what it means to pull out of a global deal, it seems much more posturing in politics, maybe playing to a base or to something that you campaigned on than the truth in the way that it doesn't seem like, I hesitate to say this, but it doesn't seem that a president or an administration can really roll back the changes that we've seen in our world already taking place.
I'm fascinated by that concept, what you're mentioning there, because having written about these issues for several years now, I'm constantly coming into contact with people who are involved in enforcing or litigating or whatever different laws that were enacted, say, in the 1970s, a lot of them, so the Clean Air Act, Water Act, kind of things that we consider a bedrock part of United States these days. And it's led to, look at our lake. It's a lot cleaner than it once was. Look at our drinking water. It's a lot cleaner than it once was. It's not just in like Michigan and Chicago. It's all over the country. We breathe cleaner air. We have cleaner water. And that's because of those laws. Those laws were all passed, by overwhelming bipartisan majorities. Richard Nixon, a Republican president, had a hand in almost all of those laws. He created the Environmental Protection Agency. Even when amendments to the Clean Air Act were passed in 1990, Mitch McConnell, a backbencher in the House of Representatives, voted for the amendments to the Clean Air Act. So something has changed in recent years, and in some respects, it's become kind of if you want to become an elected Republican nationally in this country, it seems like you have to at least say something nutty about climate change or act like it's a hoax, even if you're supporting industries that end up, doing things that actually fight climate change by, say, generating electricity in a cleaner way. And there's this whole cottage industry that's come up. It was originally funded and still is by a lot of the big financial backers of the modern Republican Party. It's kind of taken off a life of its own where they try to outdo one another by saying the craziest things on Twitter or going on, radio shows or Fox News or whatever else like that. But if you talk to a lot of folks, in more quiet moments when the cameras aren't on, they see this as a problem, and they're hearing from business leaders in their states who know that they have to do something about this. ExxonMobil, is on record supporting the Paris Climate Treaty. The shareholders of ExxonMobil just voted this week to make sure that ExxonMobil does more to be clear about the financial risks to that giant oil company from climate change. The Pentagon has been on the record for years. The generals and admirals have testified before Congress time and time again about how climate change is a risk to our national security and our interests abroad. So there were a lot of different diverse interests and voices who were going in another direction than certain people in the White House or certain people in the funding community in the Republican Party right now.
Well, it's
going a different direction. So it's not like all hope is lost.
It's fascinating. It'll be interesting to see what the president says tomorrow at the Rose Garden. Michael Hawthorne, investigative reporter with the Chicago Tribune, who focuses on environment, public health. Great to have you on the show. Thanks for joining us tonight and giving us a little bit better understanding of the news that was leaked today. We appreciate it.
Thanks, Justin.
I know this song. I'm waiting for it to kick in. Ah. Does it kick into like a ding-a-ling-ding-a-ling-ding-a-ling-ding? There it is. Just Poor Dog Pondering? Who is this? Talking Heads? No.
Nothing but Flowers.
Yeah, right. Love this song. That's a mixed, this is a mixtape winner right there. That's the Young Kaufman going, let me put this one on there. It's more of a B-side. She'll love this one. Really going to dig it. Nothing but Flowers. That's how I feel. Then I'd go Sugar Cubes after that. All right, coming up, Greg Flamm in the swap meet, 312-981-7200. As we said, there's no budget in the state of Illinois, so if the whole there's climate change is possibly in our future, so, you know, if the probe that NASA's sending to the sun actually gets us to explode for some reason, the sun gets mad, and we have no economy left, all that you're going to be able to rely on is the junk that's in your garage, the stuff that you've put away in the attic, the Bill Buckner autograph. When your dad's like, hey, Bill, you got bad ankles. My son doesn't tie his shoes. Dad. Then you've got to call in and find out what your junk's worth. 312-981-7200. That's Greg Flamm. He's coming up. 10 o'clock hour. Thanks, Rob. Yeah, we can't get rid of that building. Too many great memories of watching two Broadway actors play tough Chicago cops. The amazing thing about that movie, Running Scared, which is classic, was just how smart-assy they made Gregory Hines and Billy Crystal. Not the guys you would think about when you think, like maybe like NYPD Blue, you're thinking of Dennis Franz. You're like, oh, there you go. That's a Chicago guy.
Yeah, Sipowicz.
But these guys being all cool. Like I was halfway through it, you're like, I wonder if there'll be a tap dance in this. I wonder if Gregory Hines is going to do a tap dance. They're just going to make it cool, like a cool Chicago tough cop tap dances mm-hmm. too. They're just such a, and they were so, oh, that's such a good movie because they're such smart Alex. Like the whole movie, they're just like everything against the rules, everything like a smart comment after everything. Like they just everything was a, you know, they never followed the rules and regulations of the law. They just did their thing, and then it ended with a big Uzi battle.
Oh, yeah,
it was an Uzi. It was like a classic '80s movie.
Oh, man, they don't make them like that
anymore.
They
don't. Just the idea of Uzis in the Thompson Center. Right away, how is not, we talked about the bravery, the courage of lawmakers in Springfield to do the right thing. There's not one lawmaker that got up on the, one Republican or Democrat that got up today and said, let me bring out the elephant in the room. Running Scared is a great movie. And the Thompson Center should not go anywhere. It should be a shrine to that movie. These were top-notch actors of our time.
Yeah.
Having Uzi battles. No? All right. I'll stand down if people disagree. If there's a flood of calls and people call in, they're like, that was a terrible movie, the worst movie, we should get rid of that movie. I'd be like, all right, I'll listen, but you can't.
Mm-mm.
You automatically, you know why? Because they used to put that movie on Channel 9. At whatever time, you know, like when they used to do the Saturday night movies, you'd get a Ferris Bueller or you'd get a Running Scared or you get some Chicago connected movie. And it's just in our DNA. Like, I don't care. Michael McDonald can do no wrong.
Truer words were never
There's
spoken.
There's probably like someone in Arizona is like, oh, he's the worst musician of all time. But in Chicago, you're like, you did Shine Sweet Freedom for the Running Scared soundtrack. Like Billy Crystal, you can't do anything. You know, people got a lot of things they want to say about Billy Crystal, but I'm always like, hey, Billy's off limits.
Mm-hmm.
Rest in peace, Gregory Hines. You're a honorary Chicagoan for your role as an undercover, plainclothes, do what you will, law-breaking Chicago cop, chasing Jimmy Smits and his cocaine. On the you know, there's like one scene where they are in a car chase and they apprehend a cab, I think it is, and they end up on the L tracks. Like the two cars are chasing each other on the L tracks and ends with like a train hitting them. And I remember my dad at the time telling me, that's not possible because of the third rail.
I'm breaking everything up.
Yeah. That's just not possible. They'd be electrocuted. And I'm like, what? Why is it not possible? It's happening right in front of us. Tie your shoes. All right. So I got a text coming in. Someone, 630, said, I met Gary Oldman in a movie theater lobby. Ended up talking for more than 20 minutes about stupid stuff.
He was just like hanging out there?
I don't know. That's all I got in the text. As we were talking about earlier, we thought we would continue the conversation about the in-store slash lobby slash experiences with celebrities that you've had, especially if they're working their own merch table. We're talking about Mike Watt. He's a guest at the big table. He works the merch table for when it was Minutemen or Firehose or other places. Where have you been where you've been like, oh, I was thinking about, and I can't remember that band. This is where it gets me. And I want to say it was it's a very obscure British band that opened up for Catherine Wheel. Do you remember Catherine Wheel?
Yeah.
Great. Catherine Wheel. Mm-hmm. Great. I was into that. I had a Catherine Wheel phase.
Oh, yeah. I think everybody does. Yeah.
I got 4 month Catherine Wheel phase. And the band that opened was called Ocean Color Scene. Does that sound familiar?
Yeah.
Ocean Color Scene?
Yeah.
Anyway, they were opener. The same thing. Catherine Wheel comes on. You're about six rows in the metro, and you're like doing your kind of ethereal dance. Mm-hmm. You're kind of moving your shoulders a little bit. And I look to the left, and it's the lead singer of Ocean Color Scene with his beard just watching Catherine Wheel doing the same kind of movements. And it's such a minuscule moment. I think I tapped him on the shoulder. I go, you're pretty good, man. You guys are good, man. That was like that's the kind of stuff we're looking for tonight. You know, got any stories of meeting Gary Oldman in a movie theater lobby and talking for 20 minutes with stupid stuff.
I
want
to know what he was doing and just maybe seeing a movie.
Maybe.
I was at a show at Metro seeing a band called Old 97s who were kind of, they were around, in they're kind of the leaders in the alt country movement. They're on Bloodshot Records for a while. Rhett Miller is still going, the lead singer.
Right.
And I was in the audience, and I look over to my left, and Nico Case, who's a singer, famous singer.
Former guest on The Download. Go ahead.
Yeah. And so I was like, oh, man, I love her. She's great. And I'm like, what am I, she's just standing by herself. I'm like, what do I, I got to say something.
What did you say?
I said, excuse me, is your name Nico?
She's like, that's it. I'm never again watching a band from the floor. I'm just going backstage.
Yeah. I'm thinking she said yes, and then I was like,
is that it?
Yeah. I don't know what else to say.
That's so great. Is your name Nico? Yes.
That's what I thought. See you later.
Well, that's new information. Mary 847 said, "Sweet Freedom, Michael McDonald, great song, perfect song. Also, for great tap dancing, I would recommend White Knight, starring Gregory Hines, Mikhail Baryshnikov too." Well, I'm not interested in. Thank you for the contribution, Mary. But hey, White Knights was not a Chicago movie, was it? I mean, I like Gregory Hines, no doubt, but Gregory Hines in Chicago playing a tough Chicago smart alecky cop. That's a different Gregory Hines than we know from Broadway and Tap, right? So, Mary also says she saw Mikhail Baryshnikov in the lobby of the Congress Hotel after, was it the Congress Hotel or Congress? Looks like it was Congress Theater, maybe. After seeing Congress Hotel, after seeing the ballet Giselle. Oh, that's good. 708 says, my father bumped into LeVar Burton and accidentally knocked him on his butt while he was filming a movie. Always good. Pat's got one. Hey, Pat, what's your celebrity sighting?
My celebrity sighting is Robert Redford.
Oh, nice. Where?
In Lake Forest. Every fall they have a parade, and we were having a parade that day, and our class was having a reunion, and we got on a flatbed truck and drove past town, and they told us to go under the viaduct and come up where the stop sign was on the other side. Mm-hmm. And so while we did, we were sitting there waiting, and this car pulls up, comes under the viaduct, and comes up and parks right almost behind us. And this guy gets out, and he comes up, and we go, "Oh, my God, that's Robert Redford." And so I said to him, "We're the class of 44. And he said, "You look like the class of 38.
What does that mean?
Like, I guess we were too old.
Yeah, I guess.
I don't know. But then another time, George Clooney was in town for, was it Ordinary People?
Yeah.
Anyway, he was at a place, and he had come out, and there were girls all over the place. I did get to touch his hand.
Thanks, Pat. Well, that's great. That's the best one so far, touching George Clooney's hand. I love it.
Yeah, right.
All right, thank you. Thank
oh,
you
and there
that.
Were girls all over the place.
I'll bet. Thanks, Pat.
Yeah.
All right. That's a good one. But Robert Redford one, I'm still trying to figure out. Was he just like, "I need you to be older"? Like, is that the joke there? You look like the class, because that would be disrespectful to if you said to a class, you know, class of 44, you look like the class of 38. He'd be like, "Hey, you know." But if he was like hoping that they were older, so it's. Yeah, I'm not sure how that played out. 815 says, "I met Lou Ferrigno downtown 10 years ago. Nice guy, talked to me for a while. I'm 6'2", he made me feel small." 708 says, "Weird Al at from LaGuardia to O'Hare. His hair is indeed that curly." That's kind of good. See, did you talk to him? That's what I want to know. Because it's going to be celebrity sightings, right? But you got to be in a situation where you talk to them. Like, this is more about, like, we were talking about the musicians and Mike Wadden having an opportunity to come and meet someone, an in-store celebrity, anything where you got a chance to talk to them. But the idea of just seeing somebody on a plane, you know, Yeah,
I mean, that whenever we travel to New York, I'm, like, notorious for, like, sighting celebrities. You know, Matthew Broderick, Katie Holmes, just see them walking down the street. They're just living their lives. But, you know, you don't. They're living their lives, so yeah, you don't want to, like, right, go up right to them.
Have I told the Conerco story? That I'll tell it after the break. I've got a Conerco story that didn't. I still, to this day, that's a mystery around it. We'll get into it. Stay with us. Getting ready for the swap meet coming up here after the 10 o'clock news, 312-981-7200. Like I said, with everything going on today as the world teeters on the brink of disaster, that might be hyperbole, I'm not sure. I know that NASA is sending something to the sun. That's always that's the beginning of a bad story. You know, it started when these spacemen went to the sun. You know, it always starts that way. It's like a Twilight Zone. Anyway, the only way you're going to be able to make any money is by selling your junk. Like selling the stuff that's in the garage, in the attic, that you've saved. I was just thinking in my head, I've got a foul ball from Ozzie Guillen in the final weekend of Comiskey Park.
Wow.
Yeah, he bunted foul. And he
probably on a third strike,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, he popped it up. We were like, we had worked our way down, you know, as kids. So I got that, which was really cool. So that's got to be worth something, right?
Yeah.
He didn't sign it. I can't verify it. I don't think I even have it anymore, but it's got to be worth something. Yeah. All right, let's go to some of these calls. We were just talking about celebrity sightings, and these are fun. Wow. I mean, these are fun, too. Like, I want to say, like, the ones that I there's some great stuff that's up. The celebrity sightings that are here are tremendously creative. 847 says, I refuse to let Andy Avalos cut in line at Toys R Us. I have several busy Christmases ago. He actually told me who he was after I refused his request. He looked shocked at my meteorological disrespect. That's brilliant.
Oh, my
That's
God.
That's brilliant. Do you not know? I'm Andy Avalos.
Doesn't he own a restaurant, too? Is that the guy? There's a weather forecaster that also owns like a breakfast shop in like Woodridge or something.
Yeah, maybe. That's awesome. That's an awesome story. I met 630 says, I met Tom Green when I was working at Steak and Shake in St. Charles. We just rolled out our breakfast menu, so I got to ask him if he'd like some sausage. 815 says, I was at the Hard Rock Cafe in Tokyo, and I got to eat and drink with Dweezil Zappa.
Mm. There you go.
847 says, I peed at the urinal next to Bob Surratt at Park West a couple of years ago. I asked nothing, I said nothing, guy code. 630 says, sat next to Luther Vandross in a hotel downtown. Worked with Bill Cosby. He was a pompous ass. And at a bar called Faces, I saw Dennis Quaid in Sycamore and told him I'd like to see him naked. Too many vodka martinis. These are great. Michael, I like yours just by the fact of the two actors that you have together. They must have been filming one of the best movies of all time. What's your celebrity sighting?
Yeah, they were filming Midnight Run.
Yeah.
Yeah, actually, I was working on a building. I was an electrician at 35 West Wacker, which is the old Burnett building now.
Yeah, right.
And now this, when the shell was going up, the shell of the building, I was wondering why they were shutting down Wacker Drive. And they were shooting the scene where he sped the car into, you know, a construction site, and that was it.
And this would be De Niro and Grodin, right?
Grodin, yeah. And if you remember the part of the movie where he puts his sunglasses on the dashboard.
Sure.
Because they left the car. Yeah, right. That was the scene that they kept filming. They kept going over and over and over again. And, I mean, it was just good. They shut down the whole job. You know, it was like 300 guys working there.
Wow, that's good. That's got to be a lot of stories like that.
Really, it was, yeah, something cool to see. You
yeah,
know?
For sure. Thanks, Michael.
Yeah. Oh, you're welcome.
All right. Met Vincent Price at the Studebaker Theater after performance of Diversions and Delights. Wow. 630 says they worked at Neiman Marcus. Mickey Rooney was the best. He kissed my cheek. Barry Manilow was a jerk. That's the best one. Hey, you know, Mickey Rooney, he was the best. Barry Manilow, jerk. Six Trios says, I met Ashton Kutcher at a nightclub 5 years ago downtown and took whipped cream shots off his nipples. But there you go. That's still the age of cell phones. You got to show a picture of that you can't just say you did that. Also, what are you doing? 773 saw Tony Randall swimming at the Edgewater Beach Hotel. Love it, man. I love it. That's so good. That's so good. Barbara, what's your best celebrity sighting story in Chicago?
Well, nobody can beat me because I met the king.
Ooh.
The king of rock and roll, Elvis.
Yeah, where'd you meet him?
1969, and I can't remember the name of the casino right now, but it was in the, we went to a Johnny Carson, he had a stand-up routine.
Okay.
And during the stand-up, he said, in the middle, he said, we have a celebrity in the audience, and then Elvis Presley. And then he stood up, and everyone clapped, and he sat down, and Johnny continued. Then at the end of Johnny's show, we turned to leave, going toward the exit out of the room, and all of a sudden, Elvis was right in front of me.
Wow.
With two guys, one on each side of him. And I said, I don't know, I said, hi, how are you? And then he shook our hands and he said, hi, how have you been? And he was so sincere that when we decided that he thought we were someone else that he knew.
Yeah, he probably did. Or he knows that so many people know him that he's like, that's his move. He doesn't say, hi, nice to meet you. He's just like, how you been?
Well, but it was very
great move,
I think
either way.
Southern way, you know.
That's why he's the king, Barbara. That's why he was the king.
We did get his autograph. I grabbed a reserve sign on one of the tables and turned it inside out, and he signed it.
There you go.
Just really sweet and beautiful. It was like the end of the beginning, you know.
Love it. All right, thanks, Barbara. That's good. All right. Let me read some of these texts, then we got to get going because Greg Flam's going to be here, and we will do swap meet. I almost ran into Whoopi Goldberg once. I was leaving a bathroom, and she was going in. I did a double take, decided to leave her alone. Everyone's got to pee. She smiled with her great smile when she realized that I was just moving along. There you go. That's almost as good. I love it. 847 says, I met Horace Grant from the Bulls in 1990 at the Carson Peary Scott at the Eden's Plaza in Wilmette. Come on. There's so many great things about that text, right? There's so many great. All right. I got to stop. These are so good. These are so good. Let me see if I got one more that I just saw. 630 says, had dinner next to Stevie Wonder at the Hamburger Hamlet. That's good. I got to be security for Emmanuel Lewis at the Elgin Casino. These are great. Wow, I was just kind of killing time till Greg got here. He might have stumbled upon one of the best segments of all time. Glenn Campbell on the Johnny Carson show when Rhinestone Cowboy came out. Ooh, man, you're getting old. I like that. Oh, our last one here. Although there is a great one. 224 says, I cleaned Michael Jordan's teeth. Some sort of HIPAA? You can't tell us that? All right. Mid-70s down in the Keys on a dive trip with the boys. Awesome start to a text. Hole-in-the-wall bar, live band. Greg Allman sat in with the band unannounced the entire night. Friends of his from Georgia. The bar wasn't much bigger than a 7-Eleven. The bar wasn't even crowded. Fantastic. At some point during the night, he played every instrument on stage. Till then, I thought he only played the organ. It was a great night. There you go. Well, thanks, everybody. That was awesome. Take a break. We'll come back. We'll do swap meet. Stay with us.
It's time for swap meet. Oh, yeah, here we go. Oh, another man's junk is another man's treasure. Like a gold tape measure. When you were a kid and your fingers in your nose, today, you're a picker. Or it could be comic books or silverware. As long as it's old, has no mold, there's value there. It's time for Swap Meet with Justin Kaufman.
And Greg Flam.
Hey, that's me.
Hey, all right, it's time for Swap Meet here on the download. 312-981-7200. This, of course, a regular weekly segment where we evaluate your memorabilia, your collectibles, your junk. What you got in a basement, attic, maybe hanging on your living room wall. I don't know what your style is. I don't know what your taste is.
Right.
As I mentioned, I remembered I got two things that came up throughout the show tonight. By the way, Greg, nice to see you.
Good to see you, Justin.
One, I got a foul ball from Ozzie Guillen.
All right.
No sign. No way to verify it. Don't have the ball anymore. What's it worth?
Don't have the ball anymore. Well, I guess we got to find the person who has the ball.
I'd have to find that. I don't know where it went. I think it was thrown into a river or something like that.
Right.
Like, oh, it went in the creek. Leave it.
Yep.
The second was Pete said that he had a Sugar Cubes t-shirt
back
in the day. Real strong.
Yeah, rock t-shirts are big. Yeah, that would be worth something. I'd probably put that above 50.
But he doesn't have it anymore.
Pete.
He probably used it to clean up after he moved.
Yeah.
All right, 312-981-7200. We want to know what you got, and we'll tell you what it's worth. What do you got tonight? What did you find this weekend, Greg? Was it a good week for picking?
It was all right. I mean, you know, this time of year I do more selling than picking, so I've been at Rosemont lately. But I did manage to find a Commodore 64 computer, so kind of reliving my childhood.
Let's see it.
I was a VIC-20 guy growing up.
Look at this thing. Whoa. Look at that thing.
So I got the Commodore 64, the hard drive, a stack of programming books, and a stack of software. And if you recall, it took the 5 1/4 disc.
Those are the larger actual disks. Yeah, floppy disks.
Yeah, so you play the game. I got Paperboy, Roger Rabbit, Dig Dug, a bunch
classic
of other stuff.
Dig
yeah.
Dig Dug.
Yeah, so
can you turn it on? Will it work, or is it this time?
I didn't bring the adapter because I tested it. It worked. Yeah, I mean, but when I bought it, I took a chance on it, but it was a low enough price to take a chance. But when I got her home, powered up, everything was fine, yeah.
Wow.
So that was cool. They go for about $150, yeah. So that was great. And I got it for about $10.
I feel like, so. I don't know whatever happened to mine. I had one. Maybe it also fell in the river.
Well, the VIC-20, I had the cassette tape is what, you know, the programs were on. So that's what I was working with back there.
Well, right before, 312-981-7200, right before you came in, Greg, we had a fun segment where we were just talking about celebrities.
Yeah, I was listening, yeah.
The but one had a good one here that I wonder. 847 says that they met Horace Grant at the Carson Peary Scott in Eden's Plaza in Wilmette, 1990. Nice. After the players were done speaking to the crowd and left the stage, I stole his empty Coca-Cola can. I saved it in a Ziploc baggie for years.
Nice.
What would something like that be worth?
Oh, man.
Nothing.
Yeah,
right?
Nothing. You can't prove that.
I love that, though. That's good.
That is.
815 says, I think I have the VIC-20 peripheral support joystick.
Yep. They were third-party joysticks. So, like I said, the tape drives, software, you know. You could either program in the software from a book, or you could get the software already programmed on the tape for the VIC-20 anyway. And then when it moved up to the 64, they actually had them on 5 1/4 floppy.
Do you find a lot of memorabilia, collectible stuff around early computing?
I do, and I really, I'm an Apple guy, so the like 80s Apples, even the empty boxes for a joystick or a keyboard can get like, I sold I think 2 or 3 80s Apple boxes for about $50.
Really?
Empty.
Just a box?
Just a box, yep, yep. Because, you know, I mean, people, I don't know if they're displaying that or they have the part and they want to put, you know, put it in the original box. So
interesting. 312-981-7200. Let's go to some of the callers and we'll start the swap meet tonight. Why don't we start with Mary? Mary, what do you want to brag about, Mary?
Hi.
Hi,
Mary.
Well, first off, I didn't catch what you had that fell in the river.
It was a couple things. But the first one was, we were joking about how I lost my Ozzie Guillen foul ball that I got when I was a kid. And then I probably let it, we always played baseball near a creek, and I probably let it go in the water, and then I lost it.
Well, something with the recording thing that you were talking
about. I was talking about, I was making a joke that my Apple, my Commodore 64 was probably in there.
Yep.
Oh, okay.
Anyway, go ahead. What do you got?
I have a JFK Jr. when he was a little boy there at the memorial service, and with his little cap and his little suit, a porcelain doll.
Porcelain, yeah. I've seen those, yeah.
So it's a porcelain doll of JFK Jr. saluting his dad from at the funeral, right?
Yeah.
Right, I have that.
They made porcelain dolls out of that? Like, is he saluting? Is it an action shot?
Yeah,
no, he doesn't have his hand up, but he's perfect, you know, perfect shape.
Do you get that? Is that something that was sold at the time, or was that given away? Like, people were profiting off of that?
I bought it at an auction.
Oh, really?
Yeah, they look like they're going for about $30 for the full statue. You're showing the feet and saluting, or no?
Well, it's the full doll in the box and everything.
Yeah, it looks like they're $29. I'm trying to see if any have sold recently.
Oh, then somebody had it on Craigslist or ordered for $395.
Wow.
Ooh, nice.
Yeah, I'm trying to find it.
Mistake.
Well, yeah. No, it's not
I'm
a mistake.
I'm sure they made different ones.
What I'm learning, Mary, what I learned from doing the swap meet is that a lot of times people ask for whatever they want. What Greg goes by is what has been sold for. So
you're gonna get
someone asking for $400 and you're like, I'll give you $10 and a bag of Cheetos. Sold.
Right, sold.
That's kind of how it kind of works.
Yep.
Hey, can I ask you one more thing?
Yeah, sure, please.
I cheated a little. What about the Wheaties boxes? I have some old Wheaties boxes. Mm.
Not so well, unless they're signed and you can prove it. Usually,
no, they're not signed.
Yeah, usually they're about
like
10.
Like Bruce Jenner?
Yeah,
like,
10,
like
10
that
to 20.
Kind of stuff?
Yeah, $10 to $20. Especially like the Jordan. Yeah, the Jordan ones, the Bulls ones are like $10 to $20.
A Mary Lou Retton, perhaps?
No, but they're not signed, so they probably aren't worth anything, right?
Yeah, well. and they're larger to ship, too, so they, you know, if you're doing an online thing, you're going to lose money with those. You better.
Yeah. Mary, what I would do is I'd open it up and have a nice bowl of cereal.
I don't think I want to eat it.
Yeah, right. Thanks,
all
Mary.
Right. Thanks for calling.
Thank you for your time.
All right. So we got Tom on the line. We got Maggie. We got Mike. We got Jim. We got text coming in. 312-981-7200. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back. We'll get to everybody. It's a swap meet here on 720 WGN. Got to see Lou at the Walk of Fame the other day.
Oh, yeah.
That was really great. I invited him to be a guest in the Big Table. He'd be great, right?
Yeah.
Lou Manfredini, he's great.
He's got a lot of stories.
Yeah.
Always does.
I just always love him. Consummate professional. Hall of Famer himself. Walk of Famer. 312-981-7200. It is the Swap Meet. Greg Flamm at DuPage Picker, both on Facebook and Twitter. He is with us now, and we've got everybody lined up on the phones, including some texts as well. Let's get right to it. Let's start with Tom. Tom, what do you want to brag about, Tom?
I've got a paperback book called Maybe I'll Pitch Forever that's autographed by Leroy Satchel Paige. There's Best Wishes, Leroy Satchel Paige in it. I got it in the 60s when the Braves picked him up for a while. And they were playing the Cubs. I took that down to the ballpark. I was in high school at the time, or maybe just before, and made my way to the dugout where he wasn't signing anything, but then he signed that book. And so I was wondering what it's worth.
Consummate professional. He's like, hey, that's my work. I'm not signing anything. I'm not signing a ball. I'll sign my book.
Yep. It's a nice, it's a paperback book. It's a great story. If you know a story, most people would, who are baseball fans. But
yeah, right. All right, so what do you got for
a
autograph?
I can't find a sign, but the book itself is going for about $40. So I guess if you add on whatever his signature is going for on top of that.
It's not bad.
But
I don't know what is. I mean, he's dead, right? So you can't get
right,
a signature.
Right.
Does that make a difference, Greg? Like the idea if someone has passed on, does that make their signature?
Yeah, and it depends
worthwhile?
If they have a reputation for signing a lot. You know, like obviously Jordan and stuff like that, they're going to sign a lot. Peyton signed a lot. But, you know, someone like that, you don't hear about signing that much stuff. So that should matter and should drive the price up.
Well, do you have any idea what it's worth?
I'm going to say in the 300 range to start with an auction, and hopefully it will go up for you.
There you go.
Okay.
All right, thanks, Tom.
Okay.
All
right, thanks for calling.
All right, let's go to Maggie. Maggie, what do you want to brag about, Maggie?
Well, okay, so I used to work for the Beanie Baby Company back in the day.
Ooh.
And Ty made a Beanie Baby that he made for the 9/11. So it's the America Bear. And he had put one up on auction. And I want to say it went for about $24,000.
Wow.
And
come on, man.
And he signed it. Well, when he was signing the bear, he always signed it with a gold pen. And it had gold ink. It was kind of like a marking pen. And he left the pen on the end of his Y too long, so it made a little dot on there. So he tossed it to the side, and then he signed another one.
Okay.
I have that original bear.
Wow. Wow, that's a great brag.
It is.
That's the best one so far. Well, how about that? Like a discarded Ty autographed America Beanie Baby.
Right?
That's got to be worth. That's got to be, I mean, if that was getting thousands at the time, a messed up signature one. That's like Brewster's Millions, like the upside down stamp or whatever.
Right. I can't find the America one signed. Some of the other ones that signed one for about $200. But obviously, if you heard it was going for $24,000.
Yeah, you know, he auctioned it off on eBay and and he gave all the proceeds to the children's and the fire fund and everything for the firefighters.
Right.
But yeah, so like I said, I have the original one. I while I was working there, you know, we used to get signed autographed bears every day, and the most I ever got one, I did sell one for $10,000 once.
Wow.
Come on.
Yeah.
Was it during the heyday or recently?
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I was there from 97 to 2004.
Yeah, that's the heyday,
so.
Yeah.
Wow.
So, yeah.
Yeah, a lot of people made a lot of money back then.
So you just got like little stuffed animals that you're like, man, I need $15,000.
Yeah. Was that at the Bolingbrook facility or where did you work at?
No, it was at the it's in Westmont, but it was on like the Oak Brook Westmont border.
Okay, sure.
And after I got that bear, I actually went to one of the, you know, second parties and got it authenticated. So it's authenticated and it's in a box.
That's great. You did your homework on that. That's great.
Maggie, you're the best.
Oh yeah.
Thanks
Thank
for
you.
Calling in, man. You made my night.
I hope she gets a lot for that.
See?
When she's ready to sell anyway.
When the world ends because climate change goes crazy and we all fly into the sun gets mad. Maggie, she's set.
She is.
She's got currency.
Yep.
Let's go to Mike. Mike, what do you want to brag about, Mike?
Yes, I've got a set of, I don't know if it's a complete set or not, but 40 baseball card, stadium cards. Each card shows a different baseball stadium. They're not photographs, but it's artwork, a drawing or so in color. And then on the back, it has details about the stadium and everything like that. And it's by RJP Graphics out of Los Angeles. Okay. I bought them in the 1990s. Ooh. I saw them one time. I did a Google search. One time it came up on an eBay thing, and somebody was listing it for $80, their set.
Yeah, and that's about what I'm saying. I'm saying $90 for a set, and individual ones are as low as a dollar. So.
Oh, okay. Good information.
Good. Hopefully it works out.
There you go. Thanks, Mike.
Yep.
Thanks for calling.
All right, let's go to Jim. Jim, what do you want to brag about, Jim?
Yes, I have an original Farmaid T-shirt.
Ooh.
That's a good one.
And three-quarter sleeve. It's never been worn, never been washed. It has all the bands that played on the back, and I also have an original Farmaid hat.
Oh, wow.
So that'd be like a Willie Nelson, maybe a John Cougar
Mellencamp
in there.
Mellencamp, yeah. And I think Van Halen played that one. That was SIU, was it?
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And to the listeners, they did another Farmaid, and the newer T-shirts are only going for $15, but the one he has recently sold for $120. And with the hat, I'm sure, and never worn, he's probably closer to the 200, 300 range with that.
Think about all the hipsters, Jim, that would go crazy for an ironic Farmaid T-shirt.
Oh, Van Halen fans alone would.
Or Van Halen. Hipsters or Van Halen.
But, yeah, the fact that that was Van Hager back then. I think that was the debut of Van Hager.
Was
if
it?
I'm not mistaken, yeah.
That was like Pound Cake?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was like the first time I think they ever performed on stage.
Oh, you ate one too? Oh, good
I think
stuff.
It was before that, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Why can't this be love? 5150?
Right. You got it. You're all over it.
Yeah, I'm all over Van Halen. All right. Thanks, Jim.
No, that's a good one. That's a good one. Rock T-shirts are good.
Yeah. I like that one. That one's better than the Sugar Cubes. The Farmaid T-shirt beats Sugar Cubes T-shirt. Although, that's a good one. It says, not only you're in the music, but you're sensitive. So it's a little double trouble.
Yep.
Greg Flam.
Early Bjork.
Yeah, there you go. At DuPage Picker. All right, we'll take a break. We'll get an update on Mr. Martyr's news, and we'll come back. We'll continue the swap meet. Stay with us.
It's time for swap meet. Oh, yeah, here we go. Oh, another man's junk is another man's treasure, like a gold tape measure. When you were a kid and your fingers in your nose, today you're a picker. Oh, it could be comic books or silverware. As long as it's old, has no mold, there's value there. It's time for Swap Meet with Justin Kaufman.
And Greg Flam.
Here I am.
There you are. It's the Swap Meet, 312-981-7200. We are evaluating your collectibles, your memorabilia, your junk. Call us. Tell us what you have, and we'll tell you what it's worth. All right, let's get to it. Why don't we start the second half? Very excited. It was the Beanie Babies. It's got us all
got everyone
a little
going,
bit,
yeah.
A little edged up. And also, I would say that the concert T-shirts.
Yeah, that's
as well. We've talked about concert T-shirts, but you were saying that actually gets a lot of people. That actually, there's some money in that.
There is a lot of money in rock T-shirts, 60s, 70s, 80s. They're big money. People look for them. I'm looking for them every time I go to an estate sale in the closet, hoping there's one in there.
Someone's got hanging a rat round and round.
What was great are like the baaseball jersey, three-quarter sleeve, with some of the glitter still on it, from like the 80s.
I feel like I had a Beastie Boys T-shirt pitted out. I mean, it's just not in good condition.
Even like with holes or ripped and worn, they'll still get, like $150. If it's Pink Floyd or,
I've got
classic
one for
rock.
You. I got one for you. I still have this T-shirt. It's beat up. Yo MTV Raps.
Oh, yeah.
Right? What's that worth? What's a Yo MTV Raps T-shirt worth?
I think it'd still be in the 75 range or up. Yeah.
Oh, man.
Yeah, I think do an auction and see.
Yeah, you know. I think I lost. I think that one
it's
ended
in,
up
the,
in
river
the river,
too.
Too so. 312 says, speaking of concert T-shirts, I have a 1982 Chicago Fest three-quarter sleeve, never-worn shirt. Does this hyper-local item have any value outside of Chicago?
Yeah, I think it does. I think you're probably starting at $60 and up. If it was more of a band T-shirt, it'd probably be higher. Mm-hmm. But because it's just Chicago Fest, even Chicago Fest, I collect Chicago Fest stuff. I mean, that was one of the ways I got here was the Jane Byrne coloring book from the Chicago Fest. And but I think that would start at $60 for that shirt. Never
really?
Worn, yeah.
Oh, I love it. Now we're going to get a let's get a run on some cool shirts.
Right.
815 says, how about a Butthole Surfers t-shirt, original?
Yeah, I think you're probably in the $80 range, depending on what year.
Also, great call on getting that t-shirt. Like the idea that if you were going to a Butthole Surfers show,
yep.
If you don't go for the t-shirt, just for the fact that 25 years later you can ironically wear it,
yep.
You know, it's good thought, good thinking. All right, let's go to Joe. Joe, what do you got, Joe? What do you want to brag about?
Hey, in my antique collecting man cave.
I love it.
I have an ancient horse collar, if you will.
Okay. The
leather's in pretty doggone good condition. I'd say on a scale of 0 to 10, it's probably about a 9.
Oh, great.
With the brass horns, if you will.
Okay.
And it has a mirror in the center of it.
Oh, wow.
Bought it for decoration, and, you know, I love it. Got it about, so, I don't know, 35 years ago.
Can we do a remote at your house? Like, I'm very interested in the antique man cave that you have. You've called before.
Right on.
The idea that you're picking this stuff up around the country decorative. I love it.
Correct. Yeah. It's just selective, but never. I remember the cow horns I brought, the steer horns?
Yeah.
But, yeah, I haven't talked to you guys for, what, 3 weeks, a month, whatever. I got lonesome.
Yeah, no problem.
All right, what's an old horse collar?
The collar by itself, without the horns and the mirror, is between 40 and 75. So you probably are going upwards in the 100 to 150 range, starting, you know, an auction in that range.
So I didn't notice a lot of appreciation in it, but money-wise, but I appreciate it in itself.
Joe, you should sell the whole package.
I'm going to do that one of these days.
Yep, old horse collar, do the whole thing. Yeah. Like you become an interior designer.
You got it.
And then you just go to people's house and you decorate.
If you have 5 seconds to spare, I'm into block and tackle collection, too. I got some in New Bedford, Massachusetts. Where I got one of my initial I haven't even talked to you about harpoons.
Yeah.
I have a collection of those babies. Some of my block and tackles weigh 35, 40 pounds. The biggest one I have weighs 50 pounds.
Okay.
These were on the old mast sailing ships, if you will.
Okay.
They graced one of my fireplaces, some of them, if you will. But I've got, probably about 25, 30 different designs.
Wow.
And I paid on an average, going back 20, 30 years again, anywhere from 10 to 25 bucks in that era. Unfair question. Let's say the one I'm looking at right now would have lifted a car.
Wow.
In a factory.
Jeez, look at that.
Yeah,
the steel hook, is measures probably about 10 inches long by 6 inches wide, maybe.
Okay.
Gigantic. Hazard a guess.
Yeah, I'd say starting in the 150 range. The few that I'm seeing are like 90 to 160 and up. And it's something, if you send a picture, I could probably, narrow it down for you.
All right, thanks, Joe.
Comprende. Thanks, guys.
Thank you for listening.
And he hasn't even talked about harpoons.
Yeah, the harpoons.
That's my favorite line. You need to pull that out for like a promo. And I haven't even talked about my harpoons.
Yeah, luckily I saw an episode on Pawn Stars about harpoons, so I know a little bit about them. A lot of them were refabricated or reproduced, so it's really hard to find an original harpoon. So.
Oh well, I didn't know that we were going to get so deep.
Right,
into
manufacturing
and authenticity of harpoons.
Yep.
All right, 773 says I've got a 1981 Rolling Stones baseball type jersey concert tee. From when they were at the Rosemont.
1981?
Yeah. There you go.
I'm going to say 150 and up on that. I'm still trying to get a...
Yeah, I don't know if any of these... I just love that now we're getting, a run on concert tees. I'll give you the other ones here. 630 says, with two programs from the concert, and they sent a picture of a three-quarters arm, the Police Ghost in the Machine tour.
Yeah, that's...
Right?
It's got the numbers as well,
Oh, that's so cool.
And now I'm never going to be able to find them. Everyone's talking about them.
They said Joan Jett opened and was booed off the stage.
Yeah, Joan Jett, yeah. I thought it was the Go-Go's as well. Back at Comiskey Park, it was the Police, Go-Go's, 1983, whatever.
I love it. I want to be at that show.
Right.
Little young Belinda Carlisle.
See, the 81, someone's got one here for $15. So I'm trying to see. And he sold. Anyway, but yeah, concert t-shirts, big money.
I love it. All right, 815 says, I have an original Cuddly Dudley, plus the Cuddly Dudley Railroad given away by the Tribune from back in the day. What's a Cuddly Dudley?
It's a doll, you know, the dog. And we've had some calls before on this, and the value is if you have the dog house with the dog, you know, you're in the 300 and up range. If you just have the Cuddly Dudley, it's like $70 to, you know, maybe 150. But there's quite a few on there, so it's not as rare as you think. It is rare, but not as rare as you would think.
Speaking of Cuddly Dudleys, 312's got a matted SCOTUS annual photo with all signatures on the mat and all the justices. Justice Scalia's last year. Good condition.
Yeah, I couldn't even guess on that. I'd have to look up individual.
Is there a run on getting signatures from Supreme Court justices?
Yeah, I'm sure someone would want it.
They walk out to their cars and you're like, Justice Scalia, right? Justice Sotomayor, please, right. Sotomayor. Like they're hanging on the chain link.
Yep, I could see that.
All right, let's keep going here. I 815 says I have a Charles Lotion multifloral paperweight from 1976.
Yeah, that I couldn't find.
I don't know what that is. That's very specific.
You have to send a picture maybe of that. I couldn't find that.
847 says, from an early 70s auto show, I have an autographed, I saw them sign them, photos from Gordie Howe, Bart Starr, and Jesse Owens, and some blonde tennis star that's in the picture. I don't remember her name.
Chrissy Everett?
I don't know. They said they don't know.
Yeah. That one would be hard. If are they? Did you say separate or all together in one photo? Or
photos? OG. I think they're all. I think they're together, but I don't know.
Okay, yeah.
The text, so I don't know.
I mean, Gordie Howe is kind of a higher one. He can get $250 just for something signed by him. You know, just an autograph alone is like $250 for him.
Got it.
So
that's good.
Could be in the thousands.
Add a little Jesse Owens on there, maybe
right?
Get a little Bart Starr going.
Yep. Could be in the thousands.
708 says, for the youngsters, I have an Alkaline Trio Halloween limited edition 7-inch record.
Yeah, that's a good one.
What's it worth?
They're in the 95 to 135 range.
Wow.
Yeah, the Halloween one, it's orange color vinyl. And
Matt Skiba, a guest here on the download from Alkaline Trio.
Cool, yep.
So there you go. You know, this is not, I mean, the swap meet, generational. You're not going to get just, you get Cuddly Dudley and then you get Alkaline Trio.
Right. That's how we roll.
630 says two things. I got a Beach Boys World Tour 1989 sweatshirt.
Okay.
And a 3-day unused Woodstock. What is this? Hold on. Woodstock 1969 tickets behind plexiglass mounted on a wood plaque.
Oh, wow.
Unused tickets.
Yeah, that's, I'd be after that.
Hmm.
Woodstock tickets. Let's see.
Woodstock tickets. All right.
$50. It looks like, yeah, about $50 for one ticket.
Okay. There you go.
But they
got two.
Yeah, there you go. the t-shirt.
These are great. I got so much good stuff. And I want to get to the texts or to the calls too, but here's one from 847 says, I have one from each Beatle, and it's a letter that says, to whom it may concern. To this is to certify that the Beatles stayed at the Whittier Hotel, arriving at 1:17 a.m. September 6, 1964, occupying the executive suite, checking out at 2:05 p.m. September 6, 1964. This is to also certify the bed linen below, so designated as authentic and factual as to each of the Beatles using the same.
That's wild.
From Jimmy Hawkins, managing director. Ringo slept here. That's what it says. That's crazy.
That is crazy.
Right? What is that?
Yeah, I'd have to have that appraised for sure.
That's awesome.
It could
that's
be thousands.
I mean, hey, Maggie's still winning with a Beanie Baby that she sold for $10,000.
Right.
But, a certified letter from a hotel with a swath of bed sheet that says Ringo slept on this.
Yeah.
Come on, man. This just gets better and better. All right, let's keep going. Let me try Mike. Let's do Mike. Mike, what do you want to brag about, Mike?
Yes, I've got four autographed baseball cards from Ernie Banks.
Okay.
And then I've got one photograph from his 500th home run.
Wow.
It's, 20 by 20x16-inch photo, and he signed it, and it says it's 500th.
Yeah, that's a classic scene. That they show that video all the time of him going around the bases, and they're flashing 500 on the screen.
Well, it shows him hitting the ball, and he signed the photo himself.
Okay.
It says 200th home run. Was it May something, 1970.
Okay.
All right, we'll look it up, Mike.
Just the Ernie Banks signed ball is about 229, looks like, yeah.
No, it's not the ball. It's just a photo of him in Wrigley Field.
Okay, I thought the first outing we said
was
a
cards.
Sign. Yeah, card, okay.
I got four cards. Four baseball cards.
Okay, yeah, I see the 500 Homer Club picture. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's about 280.
Oh, wow. There you go, Mike. Get some money out of this one. Ernie Banks, good job holding on to those things. All right,
one is a timeline. It's the Chicago Professional Baseball Club.
Okay.
And on the back it says Ernie Banks, Chicago Professional Baseball Club, 1 of 25.
Wow, that's awesome. Thanks, Mike. Thanks for that.
Thank you.
A lot there. All right, let's keep going.
Okay.
All right, Nancy. Nancy, what do you want to brag about, Nancy?
Oh, you know, I have more of a question. I have a set of Johnson Brothers china that's well over 100 years old, and there's a sugar and a creamer, and the creamer was once broken at some time, and it is completely stapled back together. It becomes the talk of a dinner party every time. It doesn't leak or anything. We've sort of thought, well, maybe they heated up these staples really, really hot and slid them through, but then how did they crimp them on the other side? Did you ever see anything like this?
I haven't, and but I can tell you price-wise, like full sets are in the 850 range. And But how many pieces do you have? You have that one repaired piece and any others?
Oh, I have loads. I have 12 of dinner saucer, fruit plates. I mean, that's many, many, many.
Yeah, so then I say you're in the 500 to 1,200 range with that.
Yeah, there you go.
Okay. Yeah. I just wanted to know if you had heard about how they repaired.
Yeah,
how they repaired.
I don't know how they do that. I would assume they have to heat it up and with the staples.
Yeah,
that's what we thought, but how they crimped them on the other side is sort of...
magic.
A mystery.
Creamer magic.
Never
Thanks,
seen
Nancy.
That.
Creamer
Thank
magic.
Creamer magic. Let's go to Lou. Lou, what do you got, Lou? What do you want to brag about?
I have a Marilyn Monroe calendar. Is that worth anything?
Okay.
What year?
What year?
Oh, I didn't know. I'd have to go see where it's at.
Okay.
Oh.
I'll look up calendars for you.
Are there different years?
Well, you know, they still make them to this day. They still make a Marilyn Monroe calendar.
Oh, this is old. This was my husband's, and it's packed away someplace.
Please say 2003.
You're kidding.
Like a 1949 is running about $800. Let's see, 1952, $225.
Where do you go with stuff like this?
Well, you take it to eBay, or you find somebody in your family that's going to help you out. Does the calendar have X's on it, like you guys were counting down to something?
I'd have to go see. I'm 91.
Well, all right.
This was from my husband, so what's on it, I don't know. I'd have to dig it up.
All right. Well, I'm just curious. Cursing. I have a planner from maybe like 15, 20 years ago. And
yeah.
It was when my wife and I were dating, and she... down to the day has everything we did. So when you look back, it's like 15 years ago, and you're like, that's went neat. To the jewel.
Oh, you're kidding.
Yeah, and I'm like, this is great, but it's only 15 years ago. Right, it's only 15 years ago, but I'm saying, like, you might want to look and see that calendar might have some marking, like, went to the jewel.
Yeah. Oh, this has to be old. He was in the Navy. This was from World War II.
Wow.
Yeah.
All right. Well, that's a good find.
It's the year of the calendar that's important.
Well, yeah, of course. Yeah.
That would narrow it down.
Thanks, Lou.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks for calling.
A Taste of Chicago, July 4th, the first ever Taste of Chicago poster.
Poster. Oh, okay.
Yeah. So it's a really cool poster they sent it. It's like a spoon with the city skyline in it.
Yeah, I think I've seen that before.
Chicago, July 4th on Michigan Avenue. 50 of Chicago's fine restaurants dishing up their specialties from sidewalk cafes.
Wow.
10 a.m. till dusk. Really going to that for the dusk. All right, Elaine's on the line. Elaine, you're the one who texted about the Beatles letter.
Yeah, I did. And so I'm just curious. I've had these since I was a teenager. I
love it.
And now, and so I just kept them, and I wonder I don't even know if it's a hoax or not, but it's just sort of cool to have them. I have a little swatch of a sheet that each of the Beatles slept on, apparently, at the Whittier Hotel in Detroit, Michigan.
Yeah,
and so I don't know if is that anything that anybody's heard you've heard of, or
I would definitely get that appraised for sure. I you know, that's really rare, and if you know, there's definitely someone out there that's going to pay for that.
Yeah, I mean, just collectors, you'd feel like you'd go crazy for, like, Beatles stuff, right?
Yeah, especially.
Oh, yeah, and honestly, and I have these incredible posters from 1964 as well by, you know, some a caricature of each of them. And so these are things I've had since, you know, I was, you know, since 1964. So, and I just don't know where would I go with that. But
well, eBay is probably the best bet.
Yeah, but to get it appraised, you probably want to Google, like, entertainment appraisal, you know, and that will shoot you in the right, you know, direction.
Thanks, Elaine. That's great. That's awesome.
Yeah, they are awesome. Thanks.
There you go. There you go. Now, that's a good brag. It is. Great stuff. I feel bad because we got to drop. We got to end. And there are probably about 25 texts, and people sent even pictures of, like, 19th century sausage stuffers.
Okay.
And the lines are lit up as well. Hey, we're back next Wednesday, so just try again. Get him in a little bit earlier. We'll make sure we'll get through everything. You can find Greg Flamm at DuPage Picker on Facebook and Twitter. Greg, always a pleasure.
Always fun.
Great swap meet.
Thanks.